Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me is returning guest and fellow Russian bot, Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. Last time we talked on the Satoshi Kon episode, Star Wars came up.
Yes.
And I think what people listening to that episode don't realize is I ended up cutting out about an episode's worth of conversation just about Star Wars.
I'm not surprised.
But I'm glad that now we can have our own episode just for Star Wars and get into this. And I guess specifically we're going to be getting into George Lucas's Star Wars, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, the independent era. Yeah.
full confession, I haven't seen all the new ones.
I haven't either. I haven't seen the latest one, Martin. I just can't get myself to do it.
I haven't seen the latest one, and I haven't seen the young Han Solo one.
Oh, okay.
But I feel like one thing that kind of came up on our last conversation and just generally on Twitter is that we're sort of in the same boat Star Wars wise, where I feel like I need to tell people like, oh yeah, I used to be a Star Wars fan is kind of the phrasing. I don't know if you have a similar.
Oh yeah. I was probably unhealthily obsessed for a very long time. So yeah, that's ended circa like 2012. So.
Well, how did you get into Star Wars initially? Like, what was your entry point to it?
It was my parents. I feel like I say that a lot, regardless of the topic we're discussing, which I owe them opening my eyes and letting my brother and I explore so many different genres. And we did stuff like the original Hal Roach's Our Gang, The Little Rascals, and Universal Monster movies. And recently, I mentioned on a Bette Davis episode on Wrong Reel, also Bette Davis. So they kind of introduced my brother and I to a lot of things, and they decided, thankfully, a few years before the special editions of Star Wars were released. I think that was like 97, a few years before.
What was it, the VHS set that said,
yeah,
I think it was in the advertising where it's like one last time.
The original Star Wars trilogy on video. One last time.
Yes.
You think it's just like an ad campaign, but they were for real. They really meant it.
This will be your last chance to own the original version of Star Wars.
Leonard Maltin did the intros. Like, those are the...
Yeah, I always had to fast forward through those.
Yeah, like, I honestly probably have those interviews with George Lucas memorized. Like, my brother and I would watch one of the original trilogy movies, I kid you not, like, every day for years. And and then counted down to, oh my gosh, there's a new one coming out in 1999. You know, so it's kind of... I think we got into it kind of at the right time where we could really enjoy the original trilogy before they cut out the Ewok song at the end of Return of the Jedi and and before the prequels came out.
Right. Like, I think we're close to the same age.
Yeah.
So we just happened to catch like a specific wave of Star Wars that kind of led up to the release of the prequels. And like those were maybe like, regardless of criticism towards those films, those were like definitely targeted towards our
generation.
We were the target audience for Phantom Menace, and then like gradually it sort of aged up with each installment.
Yep.
But I know there's like some people who are like, oh, I grew up on the prequels and those are my favorites and I love them because like that's just what I'm nostalgic about. But like,
sure.
I never really quite felt that strongly about them.
Yeah.
There's things I love about them, but
right.
like I always kind of kept coming back to the first three. It's really sort of where my affection is. And there are definitely things like I love about the prequels. And
sure.
There's a lot of stuff I love that kind of came along with them, like whether it's comic books or video games or, you know, like there's kind of a lot of...
So much in between all of them. Yeah,
yeah,
there's
like,
so
like
much.
Star Wars, it's, you know, like, yeah, it's sort of films first and foremost, but it's also just like a whole universe of media that kind of comes along with that.
It's very extensive. It's just like, just even characters in the background. Like, I remember for the Phantom Menace, like seeing that in theaters, the Padre scene, like there's one character that's very expanded universe, Ara Sing, and she's just kind of there a few times.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there's like characters like that where like, if you're not totally like obsessed about, you know, the expanded universe, you're going to miss all these like little characters that basically do nothing but stand there and look cool in the movies.
It's kind of like a strength and a weakness of the films.
It
because
is.
Like, on one hand, you can have all this media that sort of enriches it, and wow, you can go and read a really great story in like Bounty Hunter Tales or whatever anthology book that like wow, like Greedo's got this great backstory and, you know, like what an interesting character. And, you know, you go back and rewatch the film and sort of treat it as its own thing. And it's like, oh, he's not really like an interesting character at all, but, you know, it lets it sort of enrich that character for you on screen.
Right.
But like, it's sort of hard to separate the films from a lot of that extra media. And sometimes it's to the film's detriment. Sometimes it's to the film's benefit.
Yeah.
And even just trying to separate the films from each other. Like, I kept trying to think, watching this time around, especially how each installment sort of changed the way you watched the previous installment, and how, you know, it would feel like only if there was ever one Star Wars film, or how it would feel if there was only ever two Star Wars films, and just kind of keep thinking about how the series evolved over time. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Especially with the, like, the original trilogy, like, imagine if, you know, it wasn't, you know, as successful as it was, and the biggest thing ever, and George Lucas had to find a way to scrounge around to make his sequels he wanted to make at the time. Because I feel like, you know, obviously with the prequels, you know what's going to happen. I mean, it's inevitable, especially if you're, you know, your parents or your family or you yourself discovered the original trilogy before seeing those. I feel like it's kind of different now with, like, the sequel trilogy. There's a lot of people, I feel like, at least that I've interacted with online, that don't care or are interested in even seeing the original trilogy, which kind of just blows my mind.
Which is weird.
It's so odd to me.
Because those are the good ones.
Yeah, exactly. And just trying to keep this, I guess, kind of nice and pleasant. But, like, really, the sequel trilogy is just kind of what do we think people really love about the original trilogy, and let's do it again and put an orange stripe on the X-Wing. So it's like, it's not really doing anything all that new, and it's recycling so many themes from the other ones. Whereas, you know, I think we'll get there too a little more. George Lucas's six Star Wars movies kind of stand on their own. Even though a few are weaker than others, they're not really regurgitating a lot of the same things we've seen before in the movies.
For me, one of the big strengths of the prequels, maybe one of few strengths, is that they don't just feel like regurgitating the same things you've seen previously. There's a bit of that. I think, like, maybe especially after episode one, where maybe the reaction wasn't exactly what Lucas was hoping for, and it sort of felt like he had to bring in some fan service a little bit more. But I mean, even in episode one, there's, like, fan servicey stuff where it's like, oh, we didn't really need that. Like, I didn't need to know that Darth Vader meets C-3PO. Like,
Right. Or that R2-D2 was, like, basically Padme's droid. And
Yeah. But at the same time, like, there's so many new characters and new designs that I think visually they're really, really great, the prequels. Or maybe, like, especially episode one, weirdly enough. Like, all the design work, and, you know, you get these, like, flares of real imagination in them that I find the more recent ones,
they're totally lacking.
They're totally lacking. I think, like, partly they're lacking imagination by design, you know.
Yes.
You don't pay however many billion dollars for a franchise basically just to be like, let's be original and creative and, like, add new ideas. It's like, no, we bought all this old stuff, let's put it back up on screen.
And then we're,
you know,
just
paid for X-Wings, you're gonna see X-Wings.
It's kind of like, you know, as you know, I did enjoy Force Awakens for what it was, but that's why I kind of separate the sequel trilogy, you know, aside from it being, you know, not a part of, you know, independent Lucasfilm, which was, like, what, 71 to 2012 when he had that company going. And it's just because it just reeks of Disney doing its market research, which is understandable. They're a company, and, you know, these people like these things, as opposed to George Lucas, you know, really having no sort of self-control and being like, I have all these crazy and awesome and ridiculous ideas, and then just totally going with it and doing it. So they're just total polar opposites in that regard. And I'm the type of person that is much more interested in the very crazy, maybe the not as good, but the creative, which is why I will lean more towards the unrestrained George Lucas over the safe Disney Star Wars, if that makes sense.
Have you read the transcript with George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and I think Kasdan, where they're sitting around coming up with Indiana Jones?
I know.
Like, the whole thing's transcribed.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like, you sort of realize reading that, like, oh, George Lucas is full of ideas, but it's like he has as many bad ideas as good ones.
Yeah.
And he just needs somebody to kind of shoot half of them down.
Yeah.
I think, like, the prequels, they're sort of overstuffed with ideas. Like, that's one thing I kind of found this time around. Yeah. It's like, there's things that are contradictory and there's things that just like don't jive because like, right. Oh, like he had an idea and there was nobody to say no to that.
Yeah. Nobody was saying
like,
no.
I think like the part of the problem with the prequels is there's like too much in them. And I think even if it's like not even sorting out the good and bad ideas, even if it's just like, okay, we're going to use half the ideas.
Yeah.
They might've been better.
Yeah, exactly. Or starting, I know a lot of people have said this is not all that original or starting like later in Anakin's life, as opposed to so early and then jumping ahead, would have been good too.
It's a really weird choice to not have Anakin be the same age as Luke Skywalker was in the first one. Because you think those paths should have mirrored each other more or less, right? Then,
yes.
You know, like the young boy off in his first adventure when he's like a teenager and kind of that Luke's path to being a Jedi would be paralleled with the Anakin's fall to the dark side. Like, you know, that seems really intuitive and... it's kind of a weird choice to have like a younger child as the lead. I don't know if it was just because Lucas thought like, oh, it's going to be like a bunch of 10-year-olds watching this movie.
Yeah, I don't know, because he like uses like that as and like if you listen to him, I guess like after the prequels weren't as well received as he imagined they would have been. Like he's like, oh well, I make these movies for kids, and I feel like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like he didn't say that much when he was making the original trilogy, at least from
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean. It is more a fantasy than it is science fiction, and it, you know, it is the traditional, you know, storytelling and and whatnot. So I mean, obviously it's going to have that hero character for kids to look up to, but I feel like he just said that more at the end.
I think so. It sort of became like an excuse, like like what can you say, these movies are for kids, and
exactly
that kind of deflects a lot of the, you know, more mature criticism of it,
right?
Or I mean, the first one, it's kind of the weirdest one in a lot of ways, and I think even if there was never any other Star Wars film but the first one, like if it totally flopped, it would still be such an interesting movie to me.
Yeah.
Like I have this sort of suspicion that the film's got like a subtext about sexual awakening for a young adolescent man that I've hardly ever see come up. Yeah. But even just the finale, I think I mentioned this on the Lo-Fi Sci-Fi episode with Dave Eves, but like I think it's all about sex in this like weird abstract science fiction way, where you have the giant Death Stars like the ovum, and you have the X-wings and Y-wings, like X and Y chromosomes, and it's like shooting this little sperm torpedo. Like I sort of contend that George Lucas is a weirdo, and this is a family film made by the guy who made THX 1138. You sort of have to remember that.
It's true.
And then like I don't think like Lucas was ever really in some way suited for making mainstream popular entertainment, and it's just like Star Wars almost through like a weird artistic coincidence has this mainstream appeal, or you know, like it happened to have that. And then I think he sort of had to reconfigure the series into being
money or creativity,
popular entertainment. I sort of think it's kind of underappreciated how much that first film is an art film.
Right.
Like there's huge sections where like nobody's speaking English. It's all like bleeps and alien words and nonsense, you know, for like a long stretch when they're
so much
know,
of
the
it is
R2-D
silent
just going
and,
around.
Yeah, so much of it is silent and then just the gibberish. Yeah. And I mean, you're right. Like I think even now, if you were to ask somebody, regardless of their age or generation or how many movies they have or haven't seen, they probably have no idea that that was a very small independent movie, basically, where George Lucas threw a bunch of hippies in a garage and said, can you create special effects that have never been done?
But that's, I think, sometimes how you push the industry forward. And it's incredible how much Star Wars impacted, you know, maybe to say film as a whole,
everything.
It's a little bit too broad, but like, specifically like popular entertainment, the idea of blockbusters. I know they say like Jaws is the first blockbuster, but it's like after Star Wars, every blockbuster on some level wanted to be a little bit like Star Wars, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And now that kind of Ouroboros has gone back, and it's like the snake eating its tail, where Star Wars is now trying to be Star Wars. And, you know, it's sort of, I don't know, it's like the first one, the stuff it was imitating, it was pretty varied, you know, the Kurosawa films and Westerns World War II, kind of like, you know, you sort of get the sense that it's all these elements that were filtered through into this single vision that, you know, it's not futuristic really. Like,
no, it's not.
The futurism in it, it's like retrofuturism, you know, it's sort of referencing stuff like Flash Gordon.
Right.
And, it's a nostalgic
right.
science fiction, yeah. you know, which is sort of the opposite of THX-1138, which I think...
Yeah, it is.
I don't know if anybody has, but like, I bet you if you were to ask Lucas, he would say that he thinks the future is going to look more like THX than Star Wars, you know?
Yeah, more Orwellian,
that's why
yes.
Star Wars, it's a long, long time ago. It's the fantasy, it's the nostalgia, and that's part of where I think the appeal comes in. While like THX, it's like...
It's too real.
It might be my favorite film that he's done, but it's also like miserable for most people. Like, yeah. I totally understand why it wasn't successful at the time. It's right. totally this like frightening alien future.
Very ahead of its time, yeah.
It is. Even in there, you start to see themes that relate to the nostalgia and the kind of looking back to the past. And
mm-hmm.
my favorite moment in the THX movie, it's with Donald Pleasance, where he's talking to the school kids.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember, but like,
yeah.
he just says like sort of offhandedly, like, oh yeah, things were really different when I was your age or something like that. And it's such a sad line that like, what was life like for this guy, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Like, how much is he's seen things kind of changing at worse, and you know, it's really sort of a haunting thing actually. And the conclusion you can kind of draw on that is, you know, the sort of nostalgic idea that like, well, the past was better, so you know, Star Wars, it's
right
this
yeah
fantasy of the, you know, nostalgic elements all kind of work together,
right? And then
yeah,
and he does something like American Graffiti as well, which kind of has more in line with the, you know, the positivity with nostalgia, if you will, and the bleak outlook that THX has. So it's kind of like, I feel like Star Wars is kind of more in that camp, obviously, of the American Graffiti, like you mentioned, where it's just kind of, you know, just reminiscing and hoping for that to continue, if you will.
Sure. And like, I think a lot of people have put Star Wars in the context of America in the 70s with the...
Yeah.
you know, the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the sort of cynicism of Watergate and all, you know, right. all that kind of feeding into the appeal of people wanting this sort of simplistic good versus evil retro fantasy.
Yeah. And I can't imagine, too, if Star Wars wasn't something that was George Lucas just kind of, I mean, just looking at what was out then, I mean, just comparatively the type of movies that were popular, the science fiction that he was up against. It's totally a complete 180 from what was a blockbuster at the time and what was popular. And then pair that with the fact that they decided to not go with disco as its score. I mean, there's just so many things that he did at the time that was out of left field.
Yep. It really feels like that the House of Cards, where if you pulled any one out, the whole thing would have collapsed.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you've seen, there's a fan edits, like a Grindhouse version of Star Wars. I think it's called The War of the Stars, if you can ever
yeah.
find that. But they took a lot of like old prints of Star Wars, so it looks beat up, and mm-hmm. put in, you know, the scene of like the original Jabba the Hutt, where he's just some guy.
Oh, geez.
And like, you know, they changed the soundtrack. And as an experiment, I thought it was really interesting just to see how... If you put one or two things back in and change the soundtrack and this and that, like, oh, like, you know, this would have been like some weird oddity that would have been mostly forgotten about. It would have been like a cult movie at best, you know?
Yeah, at best, yeah. Because it's funny, like you mentioned the music, because it's, to me, that's like the first thing I think of when I think
yeah.
of that independent era, if we want to call it that, George Lucas's 1 to 6. I mean, because that's something that definitely does not suffer, and I would argue maybe even gets better with the prequels, is the music. I think
Duel of the Fates is awesome.
Outstanding.
The
yeah, it's outstanding.
So good.
Yeah,
the prequels too, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and Across the Stars, the love theme in Attack of the Clones is pretty fantastic.
It's really
as
good.
Well. Yeah. And so it's like, and then you get to, I mean, I couldn't tell you what the themes are for the new ones. I just felt like it was, I mean, I know that John Williams did do some new music for Rey, but it's just, it does not compare.
The Rey's theme I sort of remember,
yeah.
but like, it's not...
so much recycling of the original themes, which I know that, you know, obviously those were included in the prequels when you want to hint at like Anakin turning into Darth Vader and everything, but there were original themes that were as good, if not sometimes maybe a little better than some of the original trilogy themes. So it's kind of another thing that I think is fallen off. And that's really kind of was always the soul, if you will, to those movies, to me, was the music.
Right. I you know, for a film where the first characters you see aren't even human.
Yes.
For like the first chunk of the movie, first act, you do feel like it really needs that music to kind of tie it down to something familiar, the you know, sort of sweeping classical style score that...
Yeah.
You understand just through the music what's happening and what's important. And, you know, Darth Vader, when he first walks in and you hear the music, it's like, oh, he's the bad guy. The music's telling
right.
you, as if it wasn't
yeah.
obvious. But, you know, it makes it very clear what you're watching, and it's not alien as...
No, it's not.
Or it's not alien as everything is on screen.
Right. It somehow makes it very familiar. And I feel that that's, you know, not only, you know, just the way that John Williams composed the music, but I feel also like what it's referencing. So it's referencing, what isn't it referencing with like film history? Like, right. I mean, it's...
Well, the big one it references really is the Hidden Fortress.
Like, yes.
It's basically a sci-fi remake of that. And
yeah,
also like just borrowing a lot from the kind of Joseph Campbell
right.
archetypical myth, you know, and that kind of spreads out through the whole series of films. But just, I think part of it, like, you know, Lucas had all these ideas and different elements, and he's maybe, and like he gets a lot of credit for being like a great storyteller. I don't necessarily think he is. I think he's a great idea person, but he needed some kind of a structure to graft a lot of those ideas on. So, you know, he looked right. at Kurosawa, who can tell like a really great story,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, looked at Joseph Campbell. It's like, that is the most streamlined narrative you can get, is that monomyth, you know?
Right.
So it's like, okay, I'm going to take this and that's going to be my engine, almost like a machine. And I'm going to add in all the cool parts to, you know, that I want, but
right.
it's going to be driven by this very efficient engine. So I think it needed that very sort of simplistic, familiar story mm-hmm. to work in a way.
Yeah. And then, like you mentioned, the Kurosawa references. I mean, there's then the Flash Gordon, there's, you know, Buck Rogers, mm-hmm. and then even some of the posters reference like classic cinema, like Attack of the Clones poster is referencing the Dr. Zhivago poster, and then there's the Empire Strikes Back poster, the original one that references Gone with the Wind. I mean, there's kind of like a little bit of stuff everywhere. I mean, there's the silly Gungan battle at the end of The Phantom Menace. A lot of what Jar Jar Binks does is Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton
yeah.
comedy. I mean, this is kind of just hidden everywhere in between. But yeah, I think to say he's a good storyteller, it's true. I'd say he's more of a good visionary, and he's good at getting a lot
yes.
of people that are very creative and very good at what they do in a room together to create together. I think that's kind of his two really good things about him.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly why for the prequels, it seems like maybe one of the biggest mistakes was not bringing in other people to direct and work on
yeah.
the script. You know, I think he should have had the overall
right.
vision, and, you know, like I think that's what he was good at. And you can see that with the Empire Strikes Back and
yeah.
Return of the Jedi, where he really needs those collaborators. Like, it's not a
yeah yeah
a one-man show, you know, obviously.
Exactly.
I heard he did ask Spielberg if he wanted to do Phantom Menace, and he turned him down. I think maybe he asked Ron Howard. I don't know. I think
yeah.
maybe he also asked Philip Kaufman to do the screenplay, and he turned them down. Like, other people kind of didn't necessarily want to be micromanaged by him, you know,
right.
like which I kind of understand.
Sure.
You've heard the story with David Lynch talking about when George Lucas was courting him to direct
yes.
Return of the Jedi, right?
Yes, yes.
And, like, on one hand, it's sort of fun to think about, but you can understand why for somebody like David Lynch, it would be a nightmare to work for George Lucas, because you're basically just like his... You're directing his vision by proxy. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not allowing people who want to be creative to be creative. So I understand that. I mean,
no.
I think that makes sense why
yeah.
he got who he got to do Richard Marquand.
That's why, like,
and
Irving Kirshner,
yeah.
Yeah. That, like, that, you know, they were perfect to direct those films because they're not, I don't know what the polite way to say it is. But,
I know what you're trying to say.
Necessarily as, like, visionary yeah. filmmakers, you know, like, but like, you
yeah.
know, the performances and the, like, the actual mechanics of, like, directing.
So you're saying they're like the sequel trilogy directors, Martin. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, maybe not. Oh. Maybe not. that might have been a problem with the sequels.
Yeah. At the end of the day, like, just removing, you know, Abrams and Rian Johnson from,
yeah.
from that equation, like, clearly both had entirely different ideas and visions in mind. So maybe you just wanted to pick one and stay with that one, as opposed to kind of be all over the place. Like...
Right.
Both movies are completely unrelated from each other, Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, and they feel like they're from entirely separate trilogies, and they don't like each other, and they don't know each other, which thankfully is not the case with George Lucas's six movies. Like, they kind of, they
right.
all flow, as flawed as a few of them are.
They do tell a story, and they do
yeah.
have, like, an overarching idea and
yeah.
concept, and, like...
They work.
One thing that sort of bothered me between the two main Disney Star Wars films that I saw is... like it felt like
there's no plan.
The Last Jedi, yeah, like I mean, clearly there's no plan, but it's also like undoing a lot of the stuff that like Force Awakens set up,
right?
Which is fine because like a lot of what Force Awakens set up kind of sucked, except it doesn't do anything interesting with it. I think I saw it almost right away when it came out, Last Jedi. I said almost immediately after it came out, like, I bet you, I don't know if it was before or after they announced J.J. Abrams was going to direct part three, but I said, like, I bet you, like, number three is going to try to re-retcon all the stuff that number two retconned, and it's going to be terrible. Like, I kind of knew it immediately, and, you know, then, like, a couple years later, it comes out, and that's what people are saying about it. So
yeah, I haven't brought myself to see it
yet. It's like the net income is zero when you have two filmmakers trying to undo each other's work because they don't like what's in the previous installment, you know, and to the prequel's credit, everything does kind of push clumsily forward to a conclusion.
But they have a goal, and they're getting there.
They do. Yeah.
So,
and, like, the prequels, you can summarize what that story is. It's, oh, Anakin's fall to the dark side and the rise of the Emperor. It, like, that's a very sort of simple thing that ties them all together. And, like, I don't know. Again, I haven't seen them all, so I probably shouldn't talk. But, like, I feel like I don't know. There's no unifying vision behind these new ones. They're kind of just
it goes from being too creative and just, you know, basically George Lucas running wild and nobody's saying no, but, you know, the like I said, the creativity's flying and there's an end goal and it's attainable, to we're going to be super safe and base everything on market research and we don't know what we're doing. And that's kind of
which, yeah, that isn't to say that there's not retconning in the original films, because there's a lot of it.
And
Lucas himself can be kind of like slippery when you read in interviews. He has a tendency to kind of like change what he always had in mind. You know, he sort of acts as if like, oh no, this was always the plan. But you sort of go back and you read old interviews and you're like, nope, it wasn't.
It's like, how
you know,
come kind of... Obi-Wan doesn't remember having a droid?
Oh, well, like, Star Wars also has maybe like one of the greatest retcons in all of fiction, which is making Darth Vader Luke's father, you know. And I think it's just because that, partly that came early enough on in the development of these films that it fits and it works and it feels significant and meaningful. And it's perfect. When you go back and rewatch the first one, like, I know it's hard to say like when exactly that idea came out. It might've been like towards the end of working on episode four, or, you know, like it could have come earlier or later, depending, you know, what people say, or, you know, it's hard to pinpoint. But all the stuff that they say setting up Luke's father, oh, you know, he was a great pilot and he was a Jedi. And then, like, you know, at the end of the film, you see Darth Vader piloting and you see, like, all this stuff that when you finally get that big twist, it makes sense and it works. And there's nothing, there's no friction narratively with anything that they've said before, you know.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of other elements that are introduced later on, you know, that's the one that really works. But the one that I don't know, I think, like, is a, they try to one-up that, or try to, you know, equal that with the reveal that Luke and Leia are brother and sister.
Right.
It's not the worst retcon in the series, but I think, like, that kind of sets up a lot of the stuff in the prequels where it's like, oh, wait, that kind of clearly doesn't make sense when you go back and rewatch the other. We're like, that clearly wasn't the intent when you go back and rewatch.
Yeah, when you rewatch, especially when you rewatch the original one, that wasn't the initial intent, right? And I know, like, Harrison Ford might have, you know, been a part of that because he wanted his character to die. I think it was an Empire, not have him come back. So I feel like, that was probably, oh, we had, you know, the big, you know, it's Luke's father reveal, and now we have to have their brother and sister reveal. So, I mean, what kind of reveals did we get recently?
I don't know.
Other than they apparently don't care. I mean, maybe I'm jumping ahead. They don't care about R2-D2 anymore.
That's sort of sad. R2-D2 is like the hero.
He is. And he's like, I mean, rewatching the Lucas, the six movies, his saga there. He's constantly saving everybody and doing things and fixing things.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, he saves all of, like, every single hero at least more than once. And then in the newer movies, they just, like, put a blanket over his head. Leave him in a corner.
I liked what David Fincher said about his, when they asked if he wanted to do a Star Wars movie, like, what would his pitch be? And how he saw Star Wars as being, like, from the point of the slave droids watching, like, the folly of humanity or whatever that was.
Yeah.
That quote was really great. But, like, it's kind of true. Like, these sort of droids watching their masters kind of be flawed human beings while they're going around trying to save everything and do everything, you know.
Right. But I think that, like, that dark, like, droid environment was only ever, like, we got a glimpse of in, I was like, Jabba's palace. Yeah, and that was kind of it. I feel like there should have been a little more of that, but that's just me.
There's a little bit with, like, the Jawas when they capture the droids and put the bolts on and stuff like that. They're sort of mistreated all along the way. Like, that's sort of the thing. It's done in a way where you realize you care more about these characters than the characters in the film do care about these droids.
Right.
You know, they're like them, but they're sort of seeing them as tools and not really much more than that. You know, even the sort of good-natured characters, the good guys, you know, there's some, like, that one guy in the Mos Eisley cantina who's like, we don't serve their kind here. That's a bit much for just a robot, but
yeah,
I don't know. Wow. But also, what you mentioned earlier about Harrison Ford not really wanting to come back.
Yeah.
I feel like it's really obvious when you watch Return of the Jedi, he kind of doesn't want to be there. Like, he totally phones it in.
Yeah, it reminds me of Bill Murray in the Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? That's like, good he's comparison. Just like, I'm just kind of here, like, having a good time, giving my money.
He just, like, kind of looks sort of sarcastic and...
Yeah.
And, like, narratively, they don't really know what to do with him either, where they kind of, like, stick him along Leia as she goes on the Ewok planet, on the Endor. Yeah. And he just kind of, like, tags along.
No reward is worth this.
They sort of lead into Lando Calrissian kind of being his, not replacement, but, like, he's going to kind of take over that role of the scoundrel. You know, they were sort of setting that up when they thought that Harrison Ford wasn't going to come back.
Yeah.
And you kind of look at Return of the Jedi, and it's like, oh, Lando kind of gets all the stuff that Han Solo probably would have if they never came up with that character.
You like know, the Millennium the Falcon. Death Star.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. I like Lando, but it's like, oh, yeah, Lando kind of, he's in the Millennium Falcon. What do we do with Han Solo? I don't know. Stick him with Leia, I guess. Like,
it probably would have been
more fun, actually, if they had Han Solo and Lando working together in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
I like the Han and Leia romance, but it feels like we got a whole film of that, basically. And, like, we could have done something a little bit different with Han Solo in the third one. But Harrison Ford, I can't think of another actor who looks like they hate acting in more films than he does. Like, he just, like, looks like he's, like, spiteful to be there in most of the movies he's in.
That's literally the only person I could come up with was Bill Murray, because I feel that's kind of Bill Murray's shtick, and it works.
Right. So... It's funny how some of the performances changed too over the first three movies. Like, when you go back and watch the first one, Carrie Fisher's trying to do, like, a British accent for some of it, or, like,
she's
this kind of, like, transatlantic accent, and it's not really working.
I recognized your foul stench when I was brought on board.
And I feel like there must have been some day where Lucas was like, ah, like, just drop it, or maybe she dropped it and he didn't notice, because, like, sometimes it's just her regular voice.
It's her royalty voice, which is, like, what Padme has in Phantom Menace, and then it kind of goes away.
It kind of goes away.
Yeah.
Also, like, watching all the films back to back, it's kind of apparent that she's was smoking, because, like, her voice, like, drops an octave with each sequel.
But... Yes. She probably played as a part of how much weight she had to lose to be in the slave Leia outfit. I love just all her humor with that. I kind of miss seeing that from her on a regular basis.
I know, I miss Carrie Fisher. Like, she's like, oh yeah, the giant slug dressed me in that, I killed him.
Yeah, or she's like, how my daughter loved my Pez dispenser, because whenever she was mad at me, she could just rip one of the Pezes out of my neck.
She was great.
She was great,
Did you see the draft of the Empire Strikes Back screenplay where she was making her annotations of the dialogue?
A little bit, yeah.
And changing things, and like... she has this whole, like, other career as a writer, you know, so, like, it's lucky that they had somebody like that on the film who could, you know, add something to the voice of the character and let some of her personality go into the character. Like, I feel that's another thing that the prequels kind of lack, is, like, letting the actors...
do that? Yeah. Other than telling everybody faster and more intense?
Lucas, I don't know. I think he's not the best at directing actors.
No.
Although, he does kind of work well with, like, a certain type of dry British actor. Like, I was sort of thinking of, like, a lot of the performances I like in the Star Wars movies. It's, like, Ian McDiarmid. It's Peter Cushing. Christopher
Alec
Lee.
Guinness.
Like,
Alec
Guinness. Like, not all of them liked working with Lucas, but I think he actually worked well with that type of actor in that,
that
type of performance.
Expecting them to have that, I guess, that experience in the theater, if you will. Which
it is very theatrical, Star Wars. And
yes,
like, I think on the on the Mark Maron's podcast, they had an episode with Patrick Stewart, mm-hmm. and he was talking a little bit about Star Trek and how he thought one reason why Shakespearean actors actually work well in science fiction is when you're performing Shakespeare, you have to put real emotion into words that are basically like nonsense to us today.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, oh, these words don't mean anything to us now. I have to like imbue them with emotion. So it's almost the same thing with science fiction where you have this techno babble and weird sci-fi language, but you have to give it meaning and you have to find the sort of subtext in it and put it up on screen.
Yeah, I mean that, and it's funny you say that too, because I know the I Love You, I Know scene in Empire was totally like Han Solo's idea, Harrison Ford's idea to say I know. He was supposed to say I love you too, so I think that's a good example of it. But I mean,
which is like just the right thing for the character. Like sometimes an actor's gonna know the character better than the writer does. Like
exactly,
it's just, you know, sometimes that happens.
I mean, I know a lot of people like to criticize a lot of the dialogue in the prequels, but I feel like you might need to rewatch the original ones, because none of the dialogue at all ever in Star Wars is like it's realistic. It's always sexless, it's always ridiculous, it's kind of the point. Like, so I mean, you know,
I think a lot of it comes down to performance, and I don't want to throw too much shade at the performers. I think like a lot of them are miscast, but that's not their fault necessarily. Like Hayden Christensen, what was the film called? Shattered Glass.
Glass.
He's excellent in that.
Yes, he is excellent.
I think
in that.
Like he's a fine actor.
I thought you were gonna say Jumper.
I haven't seen that in a while, but you know, but like I also think he's kind of miscast as the Anakin Skywalker. Like,
yeah, I mean, he has the look, but it's a little more than that, George. So
right, no, what he definitely doesn't have is the voice.
Yeah, like, definitely not the voice.
It's so abrasive when it's going from like he has sort of like this naturally whiny voice. I'm sorry to say, and like trying to reconcile that with like James Earl Jones's voice, it's impossible.
Yeah. And I get that Mark Hamill was that way a bit too, though, in the original one, where he was really whiny and complainy, but it wasn't to, I think, the degree that Hayden is, especially in when he's it's supposed to be, you know, the turning into Darth Vader thing in the third one, and didn't really work well then. But
and with Mark Hamill, it's also like part of seeing that character grow from being like a juvenile into an adult. His delivery definitely changes with each film, and you sort of get a sense of this character maturing, and you don't really get that with Anakin Skywalker, because you get one where he's a kid and two where he's kind of at the same point emotionally.
Yeah, he is, exactly.
Just thinking about how this is supposed to be a trilogy about his fall to the dark side, becoming evil, like Attack of the Clones does very little to like
show that.
Well, like, I don't want to say it does nothing to push that forward, because there are scenes like, you know, his mother dying and him killing all the Tusken Raiders
all,
and all that.
And the children,
he killed them all. It's terrible. But, like, at the same time, I feel like there's nothing that Attack of the Clones does that you don't basically already cover in, like, the first 30 minutes of Revenge of the Sith. And, like, really, Attack of the Clones should have been the first half of Revenge of the Sith instead.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, like, you could have almost done the whole film of him as Darth Vader, but not in the suit, and just like end it with him in the suit, you know, basically like.
You mean like the good part of Rogue One, which is like a few minutes?
Sure.
When he like kills people. Darth Vader is like,
Rogue One is so, there's something like so self-deprecating about that film where it's like, you know, they're scared to even make a bad guy that can stand up to Darth Vader, and like, you know, what the film is all about when it's like, okay, like we did our dramatic stuff, now let's play with our full-size action figure Darth Vader. Like that's really what the whole film is about.
Seriously, what it is it's like the people that haven't gotten over the fact that Star Wars came out a long time ago and they're still playing in their sandboxes with their action figures. That's what Rogue One felt like to me, and I was like, why am I here right now? Like,
but at the same time, it has this very like self-serious posturing.
No, it's I feel it's just so, I mean, because you can say that so many things about Star Wars are fit into that childish category, but it makes sense. You know what I mean? There's a purpose and there's an end goal. This is just kind of like a fan film that's filler. And it kind of, you know, and then honestly, like, what's so hard about just making Darth Vader the villain of the film the entire time as opposed to having that little short sequence? I mean, that's what should have happened. And I mean, you know, I could get picky and be like, well, why the heck was Jyn Erso going to face a TIE fighter in the trailer? And then that was cut out of the movie. Like, what the heck? Like, you know, but
they reshot like 40% of the movie.
Yeah, of course like, they
directors
did.
Directors don't exist anymore. Films are just like willed into existence by producers.
Right. I mean, I have to give that movie credit though, because in one area, at least they did something new. It was on a beach. Like, I feel like...
Sure. I think the concept was actually sort of coming up before the... Like, there might have been a pitch for it before Lucasfilm was sold to Disney even. I could, like, see it.
It might not have been great,
but I could see it being made during the Lucas era still. Like, it kind of feels like...
We're going to try a new setting, guys, because that's literally all six of his movies. I mean, I know, obviously, Tatooine comes back a lot, but, I mean, there's, you know, you got the first one, which is the desert. The second one is the snow. The third one's the forest. And then the prequels do totally new planets and locations, you know, Coruscant and Naboo and everything, and it's new and different. And then Disney's like, you know what? We're not even going to... Remember, like, those six movies, you know where you are. I feel like when I watch the Disney movies, I have no idea where I am, but it looks like planets I'm familiar with, but it's not, but it is, but it's not. Like, it's like, what's happening?
I was, like, shocked that the desert planet wasn't Tatooine. Yeah, it was supposed to be just, like, some
Jakku
other planet.
Martin.
Which, like, because you go back to Tatooine so many times. Yeah. On one hand, it's sort of overkill, but at the same time, it makes a significant location for the story, right?
Of course,
you know, that's where
Anakin, you know, was a slave.
Luke and Anakin, and, you know, that's where Jabba the Hutt is. Like, it makes sense to kind of keep revisiting that location.
Right.
So, you know, like, oh, we'll just make, like, another desert planet. It's like, okay, I guess there's more than one desert planet out in the universe. But it just seems, like, unnecessary to add in something when, like, you know, you already have a thing that exists that fills that same role.
Yeah, so it's like, I kind of like to know where I am. So the fact that Disney's like, we're kind of going to show you things you're familiar with, and they might be new, but we're not going to tell you where you are. And then initially I was like, oh, did they blow up Coruscant? Because I'd kind of be sad. I mean, that's kind of a you know, oh, and then I learn online that no, that wasn't Coruscant. That's God knows what.
Well, I thought they did blow it. I thought that's what happened.
I was like, what? Like, okay. Like, so that's just me.
That's
the
funny
whole time.
Too. And if there's like a Twitter message that has to like come out every couple of days that like clarifies the movie. Like, there was something recently about
like, is J.K. Rowling helping with these movies? Like, what's going on?
Well, there was like some tweet about like, oh, did you know that like Emperor Palpatine was a clone in the Yadada? Yeah, and I was like,
I saw
like,
that. I was
if
like,
you have to come out and say
this
to like explain your movie, like you might be in trouble. That made me laugh.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Otherwise, it feels like you're just writing fan fiction for something you created. Like, it's a really weird. I don't know.
Oh god. But yeah, I mean, that was cool about the six George Lucas Star Wars movies. Was you didn't need that filler in between to like kind of understand what was happening. It was just kind of fun. I mean, something to do on the side when you were waiting for the next movie to come out, and now apparently you have to know it to know what's happening. I mean, no, I'm all set. Like, I don't it shouldn't be that way. That says a lot about your movie if that's what's going on.
Internet Star Wars people are like really into what's canonical or not, it seems like.
Yeah.
And to me, it was never a big deal. And like, I sort of accepted, like, okay, what's on the films, that's what counts. And even that, like, from one film to the next, they sort of retcon things and change things. And it was really weird to me when Disney, like, first of all, that you could even declare, like, oh, yeah, all this media doesn't exist anymore. And people were, like, outraged by this. I'm like,
I was
like,
a little outraged.
The story still exists. Well, like, on one hand, I totally got where they were coming from, because it's like, okay, we can just take
Poof,
it wherever we want. We're not going to
have
people expecting us to tell the stories that were, you know, that like were established as the book sequels or whatever. But at the same time, like, yet like Kathleen Kennedy talking about like, oh, it was really hard to write these new ones because we didn't have any material to draw on, like the
or plan
Marvel comic books. Except they did. There's like a ton of Star Wars material that you could have drawn on.
It couldn't have been
cherry picked characters and elements and you know, things to help tell that story. Or, you know, to come up with a story.
Yeah, kind of like George Lucas with, like, you could argue with Moebius and, like, Valerian and everything. Like, there's even more material for you, Kathleen. Like, I mean, I was hoping for Mara Jade, to be honest with you. Like, when they're like, oh, we're going to do a sequel trilogy. I was like, oh, yes, okay, so we're going to do that. We're going
to
do...
Like, they didn't necessarily have to stick to the books, but they could have brought in Mara Jade and Thrawn and, like, these characters that people sort of recognize from,
from Thrawn, obviously. Media. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good... I mean, there's a lot of really bad Expanded Universe Star Wars, but there's also a lot of really good. So, you know,
which is why like a big cleansing of the slate, but also like be aware of what we have in our back pocket would have made sense instead of just like throwing it all in the dumpster. But the Marvel stuff, nobody expects that the films are going to be direct adaptations of the comic books, but people get excited when like, oh, they're taking the, you know, Infinity Stone plot line from this and working it into those movies, and people get really into like, oh, this character is going to show up, but you know, and they can completely change it. Like,
do you want me to spoil for you what character shows up in the Solo movie at the end?
Is it Boba Fett or?
Oh no, we go to the prequels, which kind of blew my mind.
Okay,
You might know because of the internet, and everybody's always angry about Star Wars on the internet.
I might know, and I've forgotten. I don't know.
It's Darth. Sorry. Darth Maul shows up briefly at the end.
Oh, I did hear this.
Yeah.
Which is, people really want to bring Darth Maul back.
They do. Like, yeah. So he's not dead either.
Darth Maul is. It's that Boba Fett thing where, yeah, maybe the expanded media kind of fills in that character, but if you just watch on screen, like, you sort of realize they're not. They're more a design than a character, you know, they're maybe a really great design and you kind of wish that there's more character, and that's why people want them brought back, is to fill that character into that design. But
it's like Jeremy Bullock though, talking about him, like he's like, oh, I just had a really cool costume and I'm so excited people want my autograph. And I was like,
right,
because he just kind of stands there in Empire and then he just like really kind of just dies like a bitch in the beginning of Return of the Jedi.
He does. Which, as I've gotten older, like you know, when you're a kid, it's disappointing. It's like, oh, like he didn't even do anything cool. But now when I'm older, I'm like, that's kind of awesome that he just goes out like a chump. Like, he's just, he sucks. I don't even care. But like, Star Wars is full of these kinds of characters, and like, they keep trying to introduce new ones and they keep making the same mistake.
Yeah. I mean, he was in that holiday special cartoon. So, I mean, I guess he's got that.
He's the best part of that holiday special cartoon. It's like the cartoon is the best part of the holiday special.
Well, I do like when Princess Leia sings, but that's just me.
I was already planning on ending the episode with that music, but now I think I have to.
Okay.
It's so weird that the Star Wars theme song is lyrics.
Yes, isn't it? I think it's amazing. It's like almost Weird Al amazing.
The Star Wars Holiday Special, there are some things about it that feel like very George Lucas-y, when you just have like a bunch of Chewbacca, like a bunch of Wookiees just standing around talking to each other and it's not subtitled.
Yeah, I always wish there was a real Ewok language.
The Ewok language. It's just yub-nubs.
Exactly. Do the Porgs have a language? I don't think they do.
Oh, I don't know. I think they're more like animals than...
Okay.
Than like,
yeah,
intelligent thing. I don't know.
There's stuff you can buy the stuffed animal, Martin.
Okay. I was wondering about Jar Jar Binks this time around watching, if the character would be way more beloved if he wasn't speaking English and was talking like in an alien made up language like Chewbacca or R2-D2, if that would make the character much more endearing. Or I feel like, I don't know, Jar Jar is so close to being workable.
Yeah, he is. Like, there's so much potential that is there. And then it's just kind of, nobody said no.
I love the design and, like, the kind of idea of through his clumsiness kind of pulls things off. Sort of, like you said, Harold Lloyd or Buster Keaton kind of a character. But
exactly.
It's like, something went wrong in the lab. You know, there's that, like, infamous behind-the-scenes clip of Lucas saying, Jar Jar's the key to all of this. We need to get him to work. And
Jar Jar is a key to all this. If we get Jar Jar working.
It's like, he knew it was going to be trouble, but it just didn't quite...
Well,
you know, it could have been trouble, but like, he just couldn't quite get it to work right, I think.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, you know, he did get Palpatine where he needed to be, so...
That's true. There is some, like, interesting about the useful fool kind of role that Jar Jar plays, but, I mean, you can kind of see how the backlash fit into how he's treated in the prequels, because he's given like a smaller role each time.
Yeah, like I barely even remember him being in Revenge of the Sith, and then
he's just in like one shot basically, and
just kind of in the
like,
background.
I think I know there's that like internet fan theory about Darth Jar Jar, which I don't necessarily believe in that, but like I absolutely think that he would have had a bigger role in the prequels, or you know, Lucas was planning on having him have a bigger role until the episode one reaction.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But he's not the problem with episode one, though. Like,
no,
he's a
character
that doesn't quite come together in this lovable way. I kind of like Jar Jar. Like, again, like, I like the design and I kind of like him in theory.
Right.
But, like, who's a much bigger problem as a character is Qui-Gon Jinn, I think.
Oh, gosh. Tatooine.
He doesn't need to exist in the film.
He doesn't know, like, how to pronounce the Star Wars words either, which is just so funny.
Yeah, I know. And I feel like George Lucas was, like, too intimidated to correct him or something.
So we got this great actor, guys. And, like, just let him do what he wants.
Oh, my God. Poor actors have to pronounce all these words. Like, there's that clip of the kid who played Anakin Skywalker trying to pronounce Coruscant, and Lucas is just going, like, cut. Like,
or, like, Peter Cushing in, like, the original Star Wars, he's, like, Princess Leia. And it's just like, yeah. Between that and
you just show up on the day, and we're gonna go with that, and
yeah,
fine, good enough. But what's really weird is that Obi-Wan Kenobi's not the main character of episode one,
right?
You know, it should have been like, who am I to say what should have been, but what I think would have worked better is if he's going on his first adventure basically off on his own. He's just finished trading with Yoda, who you never see in the prequels. Yes. You know, and
yeah.
It's like, you know, Obi-Wan, when you go back and watch the old ones, it's like he was never meant to be like a pilot. He was never, you know, he was this like rustic, ancient, cold knight person who, you know, there was nothing like modern about him, right?
No.
And, you know, he doesn't know how to fly a starship, I don't think. You know, that's one reason why they need Han Solo. So, like, you know, and they mention Anakin was the best star pilot in the galaxy. So it's like, okay, he's off on his first adventure. He's got to save the queen. You know, he needs a pilot to help him get from yadada to yadada. And,
right.
You know, that's how Anakin would come into the story. And he realizes, oh, he's strong with the Force and this and that. Like, you know, it seems like that should have been really intuitive in how you're going to construct a story about, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin's relationship, their friendship, and how it goes bad. And it's just, again, Lucas inserting too many ideas. It kind of jams it full. And it's like, now we got to have this Qui-Gon Jinn character in here who really serves no purpose and kind of takes away from the characters who should be, you know, the spotlight.
Right. Other than getting the Jedi Council to agree to train Anakin, what else does he do?
Right. Yeah, like, I guess he kind of orchestrates getting Anakin from Watto. And
I mean, Obi-Wan could have done all of that, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah, Obi-Wan could have done everything that Qui-Gon Jinn does.
Right.
And, you know, that would get a chance to know young Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, and I think that was probably the plan early on, because you look at some of the concept art for episode one, and there's, like, shots that have Qui-Gon Jinn in the final film, and it's just Obi-Wan Kenobi by himself. You like him running with Jar Jar Binks on the planet and stuff like that. Like, I bet that was probably the plan initially. And I think Lucas just had to, like, let's add a character, you know.
Yeah.
Let's create another thing we can make an action figure out of. I don't know.
Or it could have been, I mean, I don't know, maybe Liam Neeson, like, gave him a call and was like, I really want to be a Jedi. Like,
probably. I mean, you know, who knows?
Because Sam Jackson did that with his lightsaber having to be purple. So, I mean.
Right. I feel like Lucas, they always say that, you know, they suggest these things and he's like, no. And then it ends up kind of happening anyway. Like, I thought it was really funny. Mark Hamill on Twitter was talking about how after Empire Strikes Back, he pitched to George Lucas that Boba Fett should be revealed to be Luke's mother in disguise and like a secret agent, double agent for the rebellion.
It's a really cool idea. Was like,
That's a terrible idea, Lucas said to him and shot it down. But then you watch Return of the Jedi.
And he does it with Leia, basically.
Yeah, he basically does it with Leia dressed up like the bounty hunter.
Right.
And, you know, so like, I think he actually does work with the ideas that are suggested to him when he has them, you know, or like, you know, turns them into something. It's just like he probably doesn't seem that open, you know, or maybe doesn't seem like somebody who's easy to approach with those kinds of ideas. Like, I know his ex-wife Marsha Lucas, who edited Star Wars and was like, you know, an important part of why these original films were great, sort of talked about how George Lucas emotionally could be kind of shut off, which I totally believe. Like, you know, the prequels feel like movies made by somebody who's
removed,
emotionally removed. You know, she said like editing American Graffiti while he's in the garage working on the script for Star Wars and working on Star Wars and all this, I think she said like he almost never complimented her. It was like she said it was rare, you know. She cut the, I think it was the scene where Darth Vader dies.
Yes.
She said, like, oh, you know, he said, oh, you did a really good job with that scene. And she said, that was so rare coming from him.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people like to try to blame it, especially on with the prequels, on the fact that, you know, it's CGI and it's all blue screens, which is not entirely true. And I feel like I have to say that to people a lot. I mean, there are absolutely the blue screens and the people walking around with those like golf balls and whatnot. And but but I mean, a lot of the prequels were shot on location. Like I know, like for example, the Naboo Palace was in Italy,
and there's miniatures, and
tons of miniatures. Yeah, it's not just, you know, just the CGI, and there's, I mean, the costumes too kind of like blow my mind. Like just even thinking about the ones that were done for Padme in Phantom Menace, there's a lot more going on than I think people maybe even just want to admit. Maybe they just want to blame it on the way that movies were changing then, but that's not the case. Yeah.
I mean, it did sort of push the industry in that direction, I think. Maybe mostly Attack of the Clones. It's kind of the one where everything was kind of shot on a blue screen not everything, like we were saying, but so much was done on a blue screen that it kind of showed you could do a whole film in that blue screen environment and just create your settings. And like other films were coming out around that same time. You had like Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow or Sin City, where it's just, we're going to create the whole world of the film, the look of the film in the computer. But, you know, the Star Wars prequels definitely were a strong nudge in that direction for the film industry as a whole. And now, like, everything uses blue screens and stuff you would never even think of. That, like,
removing a lot of the creativity, honestly.
Removing a lot of...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it depends. Like, I think it's sort of it's a tool that can be a crutch, you know.
Yes.
I mean, I was watching... You know the John Adams HBO show?
Oh, yeah, I love that show. The show's wonderful.
Like, what's shocking to me is how much of that was digital.
Yes, yeah.
Like, I can't believe it when I'm watching it. And it's so effectively used, and it's so good at kind of taking, okay, we're going to build the set up to here and then extend it digitally. And they're so clever about how they do it. It's so well done, you know, that there's nothing I can say about the use of digital in that's lazy, or blue screen in that's lazy. It's used beautifully, you know. And I like a lot of digital artwork and designs and things like that. But at the same time, like, I think I see where people are coming from saying that, oh, the blue screens were a crutch for these films, because like you have all those notorious couch shots in the prequels,
right?
You know, and it just feels like, created something amazing around these actors. And
or the entirely stressless Attack of the Clones like droid factory scene was like, well, Anakin and Padme can't die, so I'm just gonna like sit here and just like, I don't care.
I mean, that's sort of a big problem when you do any kind of a prequel, I think, is you remove a lot of the dramatic tension. I think what should become a strength is the recontextualization. You can take things that you know and twist them and change them when you do a prequel. That's usually not done well, but I think that's, if you're going to do a prequel for anything, that's the big advantage. Like, I was thinking the other day about how Naboo should have just been called Alderaan in the Star Wars prequels, because
I agree with you.
You know, you never see anything on the planet Alderaan in the first one, and it's just, you know, that a bunch of people died, and it's this horrible space genocide when the Death Star blows it up. But like, to actually have three films of seeing that planet, getting familiar with the characters, the culture, everything, that would have made that moment in the number four so much more impactful.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a very small change. That's just changing a name, you know, that's nothing else.
Yeah. Because I think all you ever see of Alderaan, like in the prequels, unless they've been edited again, is like the very end of Revenge of the Sith, when like baby Leia is brought to Alderaan, and it's like a few seconds.
And that's weird to me too, is that Princess Leia, she's a princess, like she's royal, but it has nothing to do with the fact that her mom was a queen.
No.
Like, they're completely independent of one another. Like,
no.
It's really, really strange. I think, isn't like, just it? Writing it, George Lucas was like, oh yeah, she's a princess, so her mom's got to be the queen. And then, like, somehow, this was not thought through very well.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's also that weird thing Lucas created, though, with the politics, though, of, I mean, gosh, all the politics, but the politics of Naboo, where it's like people would vote for their queens, apparently.
Yeah.
And
like, there was an
election.
It's very, very strange that she's like retired as queen and becomes a
senator. Now she's a senator. Yeah, she's downgraded a bit.
Like, it would have made more sense if she was just the queen of Alderaan and then like, oh, okay, Leia's her daughter.
Sure.
You know, so like you could have actually done a lot of things like that to recontextualize and could have actually added dramatic ammunition to the other films, but instead it kind of just sort of muddles most of it.
Yeah. I don't know if tame is the word, but it kind of right. is. Yeah. I mean, there's so much that could have been done there. And it's funny you say that too, because like with the whole like incest thing, like Leia in Jedi, when like Luke tells her that, she's like, somehow I've always known. It's like, wait a minute. Like...
No. People always bring up like the kiss in the first one, the kiss for luck, which is pretty harmless.
Yeah.
And then like, I know that the second kiss is in the beginning of Empire when she's just trying to like make Han Solo jealous.
Yeah.
The third kiss, however, is not that harmless at the end of Empire Strikes Back.
Nope.
I feel like people always forget that third kiss, like after she rescues him. And
yes,
I think they were always sort of setting her up to have some use of the Force. Like, you know, when Luke calls out to her, she hears and rescues him at the end of Empire. And
yeah,
I think there's a line where Yoda's, like, you know, when they said like, oh, like Luke's our last hope, and Yoda says, no, there is another. It's probably alluding to Leia, I assume. Like, that's what that line was.
Yes, yes.
But it feels like they didn't really know what to do with that, and maybe she was going to have a different role in Return of the Jedi originally, and they just had to like come up with something that kind of fit.
They have her hang out with the Ewoks for like half the movie.
I like the Ewoks.
I do too. Just think there's whole generations though of people and kids out there now that do not know about the Ewok songs. That was completely edited out, so that
right. When Star Wars was supposed to be just like one big movie,
yeah.
They were supposed to be Wookiees, right?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, they were, which is why we get Kashyyyk in Revenge of the Sith. Yeah.
Instead, he just like cut them down to one third the size and swap the name backwards. Like, Wookiee yes. is just Ewok backwards. Like, that's not yes. that creative.
Also based on George Lucas's dog.
It's funny.
Indiana, yeah.
You know, talking about splitting it up into three movies, he never really went back and changed the climax, so like you have to bring the Death Star back a second time.
Oh Lord, yeah.
Return of the Jedi, it has a lot of problems, but it's also maybe my favorite.
It is it's still, I mean, like I said, I haven't seen the new one, but I'm pretty confident saying it is still the best Star Wars space battle by far.
The space battle is fantastic. I feel like all the stuff between Luke and Darth Vader and the Emperor is the best
yes.
stuff dramatically in the whole
yes.
series, to the point where I think it's kind of underrated even by like a lot of Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
And just philosophically, like how it deals with the idea of good and evil and the revelation of Darth Vader being Luke's father is right. really sophisticated and thoughtful. And,
it is.
You know, you sort of alluded to the references to Japanese cinema, but I feel like there's something really like mm-hmm. Eastern philosophy in it. It's not good triumphing over evil. It's more nuance than that.
It's redemption.
Well, like, it's what saves Luke from going to the dark side is knowing that there's some darkness in him, that
right.
if Darth Vader was his father, then he could turn to the bad side as well. He could be evil as well. He has some evil in him, and acknowledging that is what saves him. And
right.
what saves Darth Vader, it's, you know, Luke is his son. I mean, Darth Vader's like a murderous space Nazi, but at the end of the day, there has to be some good in him because Luke came from him and he's good.
Sure.
So there's like a yin and yang kind of relationship between the two of them.
Yes.
And that's what saves them both, really, at the end. You know, that's where Darth Vader's redemption comes from. And that's, you know, so it's not good triumphing over evil. It's a real balance. Like, it's about
it is.
A sort of philosophical balance. And, you know, when they talk about in the prequels, that's actually one thing I think does contribute positively to the original films. It's that talk about the prophecy of you know,
the chosen one
might be the one to bring
right.
balance to the Force, and he
right.
does
right.
bring balance. He kills all the Jedi and then kills the Emperor, and it's sort
yeah.
of you know, it's not in the way they expect, but like that's kind of what's interesting about it. It's not good triumphs over evil. It's that, you know, the order of things is
right.
to find a certain balance,
is restored, if you will. Right.
And like the Jedi kind of suck in the prequels, and like that actually I'm still not sure how to feel about that, but
they all just kind of,
I feel like
that
there. Does kind of yeah, like, which it's almost an interesting approach. Like, I some people I know who do fan theories really try hard to make it sound better than it does, but I do kind of like the idea that the Jedi are this sort of out of date institution that's sort of like, in the original films, how they have this they talk about, like, oh, this ancient religion and nobody really believes in the Force anymore. And, like, I think if there was more of a focus on that, like, Jedis are basically considered irrelevant, I think that would have been more interesting. But it's also hard because, like, the, you know, most of the main characters in the prequels are Jedi, so that's all you see for a lot of the
Jedi and politicians, prequels. Yeah.
Jedi and politicians.
I mean, how good are those Jedi if they don't know that, like, Padme is the real queen the whole time in The Phantom Menace? Like, they have no idea.
Right.
Like, she's like a 14-year-old teenager and you guys can't figure this out. Yep. Like,
and I feel like Attack of the Clones gets so close to doing something really interesting with that, with Christopher Lee's character.
Yeah.
There's that scene where he's talking with Obi-Wan Kenobi and he tells him outright, he's like, the Jedi aren't aware that there's Sith in the Senate controlling things. And
yeah.
Really, I kind of wish it had gone in the direction of the bad guys in this will be the good guys of tomorrow and you're on the wrong side of history.
Right.
You know, if that was the theme of Attack of the Clones, that would have been, you know, really cool. But yeah. Instead, it sort of undercuts that by having the Emperor, or he's not the Emperor yet, but Palpatine kind of pulling the strings of both sides. And,
right.
You know, it kind of convolutes that in a way that's not really as impactful as saying something as potent as, okay, the heroes of today that you're watching, they're going to be the Empire tomorrow.
Right.
Thing. And it's like that idea comes up and then it's squashed. And again, it's the idea of overkill.
Yeah, it is the overkill idea and the Jedi Master Sifo Dyas that ordered the clone army. Yeah,
I kept thinking, like, there was going to be some reveal there.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's really strange the way it's structured, like a mystery, but the mystery kind of dissipates.
Yes.
And it, as soon as you get to, like, an army of clones, I guess you don't need any more, but...
yeah.
You know, when there's sort of some talk about, like, Qui-Gon Jinn being Christopher Lee's apprentice.
Yes.
And...
yeah.
I thought, like, maybe there's going to be a reveal that Christopher, like, Count Dooku used to be Sifo Dyas, and he's the one, or, you know, I thought there would be, like, some more to it, but there isn't really.
Yeah.
But, like, even the decision to have the Army of Clones as the answer to what are the Clone Wars is really kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's a cloned army of Boba Fetts. People like Boba Fett, so here's a million Boba Fetts.
Here's Jango Fett, Martin,
Or Jango Fett, right.
Yes.
Jango Fett, who is
Boba Fett's
dad. It's enough to repaint the action figure and
blue.
Save money on the sculpts.
Now it's blue and silver.
Which, again, like, I'm sure he does more than Boba Fett does in the original films, but he still goes out like a chump. Like, these guys are not great.
No, they're really not. And I don't know if we can blame the jetpacks.
The jetpack, it looks cool, but it would be like, you know, Return of the Jedi, where it would just get you in a giant sandworm stomach or something.
Yeah.
But I think they even retconned Boba Fett's voice, or not retconned, they like special editioned further the special editions by like changing Boba Fett's voice to Tamir Morrison.
So much. It's ridiculous.
He kept changing stuff. Like, people always say, like, yeah, the original's in the special editions, but like,
there's multiple special editions.
The special editions, yeah.
Yeah.
The worst edition was the
97 one.
Darth Vader.
Oh boy.
In the Return of the Jedi, like at the very end when he's going to save Luke, it turns this like really emotionally powerful moment of just like the close-up on the mask and like you're working out like what he's feeling on the inside into like no.
Yeah, and he's still got like the electricity running through his mask and you just hear that no, and it's like okay, like
it's so silly. Or the Luke Skywalker scream when he's like, I'll never join you, and Empire Strikes Back, and he like jumps off, you know, like, I'd rather kill myself than join you, and but he adds this screaming on the way down.
I was hoping they would all just be the Wilhelm screams. Everything is, but but I'm still thrown off by, I know it's so long ago now, but like literally having that Jabba the Hutt scene that was initially cut out of A New Hope brought back into it. And then there's that scene, which I don't know if they fixed it since then, but it looks so clumsy because of the way they edited it, how Han Solo walks over Jabba's tail. And it looks like he's stepping over a box. Like,
yeah. I guess... They needed to animate over this 40-year-old footage and try to make it work that, like, probably was never really intended for...
just don't put the scene in, guys.
I know, like, George Lucas kind of, again, like, revised history by saying, oh, yeah, I always meant to go back and, like, animate something over top of that. Except if you look at the blocking, that's clearly not the case. I think probably what happened is he had an idea for Jabba the Hutt in his head and oh, we don't have the time or money to shoot that for one scene with yeah. like, a creature.
Yeah.
I'm just going to film it with this guy. I don't really like it. I'm just going to cut it out. Like, I'm feeling it's more like that.
I mean, I was hoping they would actually just put, like, the fez on Jabba, because initially that's what he had.
The fez is cool. Since he's supposed to be Sidney Greenstreet,
I just, like, maybe I'll finally get it.
That's such a cool addition.
But also with, like, added scenes is, I mean, the obvious one, which, you know, the who shot first thing. I think it's kind of a little boring, though, since everybody's upset about that. But, like, the crowd surfing stormtrooper on Coruscant on the end of
I forgot Return about that. Of the Jedi.
I'm just like, wait a minute. Like, what's going on? Like, okay. But, yeah.
The special editions, they were cool at the time just to see some, like, yeah. special effects and, like, yeah. you know, give a refresh. But sure. it's sort of... It's too bad that now that's the go-to version.
Yeah.
I mean, there's sort of versions of that happening with other movies. Like Amadeus, it's hard to find the original cut, and that's all you true. Find is the extended cut these days. And,
yeah.
You know, like, it happens with other films, too, where it's like, oh, that's just the version that's
Amadeus
gonna
is
be
so
in circulation.
Great. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Amadeus is perfect, and, like,
it is so
the extended
perfect.
Cut is not.
Like, oh, I know.
You know, I think there's maybe only one scene in the extended cut that the film would have benefited from keeping, but, like, there's stuff that's so much worse by being expanded.
Yeah.
Like, the scene where Salieri, he's infatuated with the singer.
And oh, then yes.
They have the scene where, like, she's on stage and then Mozart's fiance comes up, Stanzi,
yeah.
and
yeah.
he has to, like, introduce her to the emperor in front of the singer.
Yes.
And she just whacks him with the flowers.
Yeah.
And, you know, Salieri's narration, like, then I knew, like,
he had her,
and
yeah.
It makes Salieri this, like, very observant, wry kind of character working out what happened.
Yes.
But in the extended cut, there's this whole scene where he goes backstage and, like, they talk and, like,
yeah.
it just makes him seem dumb that, like, he didn't figure it out immediately, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So
less is
like
more in that regard.
Less is more. Yeah. Less is more.
Yeah. Unless it's, you know, people complaining about, like, the length of The Irishman, which then I send them the gif of the Emperor going too many notes. You guys are fine binging, like, these shows on Netflix that are not good, but, you know, too many notes for this one. Here we go.
I don't know who said it, but it's a good saying that no good movie's too long and right. no bad movie's too short.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Oh, this is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Me too. Oh my God, it's so good.
And it actually deserves its multitude of awards and recognition, which is kind of amazing. So, yeah.
1980s, the Oscars were a little bit more on point. Although, I think it's cool that Parasite won this year. I was shocked.
Yeah.
I was, like,
yeah.
actually
yeah.
surprised that they would go with that.
Yeah, that movie was really good. Yeah, I'm more of a fan of A Hidden Life, which I'm sure you know, but...
Yeah, of course. Oh. Speaking as somebody who likes Jojo Rabbit, actually, it's
me
insane
too.
To me that, like...
People are so sensitive.
Well, like, all the conversations about it are insane.
Yes, back
and
to the Emperor from
also,
Amadeus.
It's not even, like... But it's not even, like, the best film to deal with fascism.
No,
I don't know. Have you seen The Painted Bird?
I want to see that so bad. No,
oh,
I haven't.
God.
I have been able to. It's not playing anywhere near me, so it's awful. Did you see that at TIFF? That's what I think you might...
I saw it at TIFF, yeah.
That's
why.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was, and then I was just asking somebody, and he's like, oh yeah, are you going to go and see that, like, Czech film with Harvey Keitel? And I was like, I am now, so I went to see it, and apparently it got, like, a really negative reaction at Venice.
Uh-huh.
Like, a lot of the movie is, like, horrible, horrible things happening to a small child, but,
right.
you know... And the cast is really amazing, like, Harvey Keitel and
yeah.
Barry Pepper, but, like... The kid from Come and See is in it.
Oh, okay.
And, like, a lot of times, just through the casting, it kind of adds something that goes beyond just the performance, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's really, really good. And Hidden Life, of course, you know?
Oh, yeah, I love that. It was so wonderful.
I feel like Hidden Life just touches on stuff that people don't like to hear.
It does.
Again, like, I like Jojo Rabbit, but it gives a very, like... Oh, fascism's bad kind of message. And, like, Hidden Life, you know, there's that one part where the guy who's painting the church is saying,
right.
people like to look at these images and think, oh, if I went back in time, I wouldn't be one of those people who crucified Christ. And, you know, like, the film's kind of saying the same thing. Where
it
it's
is.
Like, you know, you like to think that if you were in Austria or Germany at that time, you wouldn't be a Nazi, but you probably would.
Right, just how mainstream it was. And then I guess the mob mentality, too.
Like, chances are, if you're doing the real... right thing
mm-hmm.
at a point in history
mm-hmm.
you're not going to feel good about it. It's going to feel awful, and it's going to hurt the people close to you, and it's going to
and they're probably going to kill you.
Everyone's going to call you, like, a traitor and
yeah.
something horrible, and, like,
yeah.
that's what it's going to mean.
Yeah.
You know,
and just his understanding of sacrifice, really, which I don't think a lot of people are able to handle that.
Star Wars, so much of it's about the relationship with technology, too.
Yes.
Or not even just technology, but like objects, like the emotional attachment to like a lightsaber or the Millennium Falcon, or, you know, the emotional fear when you see the Death Star or Star Destroyer. And, you know, right. You actually have objects imbued with personalities. Like, that's kind of what R2-D2 is, or C-3PO, you know. And I'm pretty sure, like, George Lucas, he was almost a mechanic, right?
Yes. And he has a fascination with cars, too. Oh. Even too with the way that the technologies in Star Wars, and I love how then they decided for the prequels, even though it wasn't, I mean, in big picture, what, that's like 20, 30 years before the A New Hope, and depending on which one you're at, the ships are different, like, and a lot of them seem just like brand new and clean, and then that kind of idea of what maybe the 1950s thought the future was going to look like, which I thought was kind of an interesting decision, because it's supposed to technically be the past, if you will. So I thought that was a good choice.
It really works as like the last days of the, you know,
the Republic,
the Golden Age, or the Republic.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's sort of interesting how much of that backstory is already in the first Star Wars film.
Yes.
I actually kind of wish that the prequel stuck closer to the backstory as laid out in the first Star Wars movie. But, you know, like there's stuff you sort of half remember as being only in the prequels, but, you know, there are things that tie directly in this sort of surprising way, with Peter Cushing coming up being like, oh yeah, you know, we're not going to have to worry about the Senate. The Emperor just dissolved it. And, you know, in some ways they actually do meet up really well going from Revenge of the Sith into the first one, as far as the political stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, just this idea of the fall of the Republic, there's the ties to history with like the fall of the Roman Republic and Caesar and all that. But just that depiction of everything's brand new in the prequels felt distinct from the originals. And
yes,
it makes sense in that way. It's also like nothing is going to really endear you in the way that you're endeared to like a worn leather jacket that you like, you know, the Millennium Falcon, you sort of fall in love at first sight with that, or, you know, you sort of make these attachments to these like beat up droids. And then when things are sort of new and shiny, it's, for whatever reason, it seems like there's not that same emotional resonance.
Yeah, exactly. And then looking at the original trilogy and then the state of the galaxy and maybe the lack of everything that they had previously when the Republic was healthy and alive. So it kind of shows that they're having to deal with and make more use of things. So I kind of like that logic that kind of exists in that universe. Even now, I feel like, just looking at a lot of recent science fiction, if you will, like The Martian and Ad Astra, that's kind of like they still don't understand that logic, and all the spacesuits look the same. Like,
that's one thing that really bothers me, is
everything's
like,
orange.
I feel, like a lot of science fiction stuff feels like really samey lately. Like it's coming out of the same like concept art workshop, you know, all the spaceships and spacesuits like you mentioned, and you know, you sort of want like a more distinct aesthetic. Like when you go back and watch like some of the Soviet sci-fi movies, just you know, like, oh, it's a spacesuit, but it doesn't look anything like a spacesuit in a American science fiction movie. It's just like a different idea of the aesthetics,
like the obvious one, like Solaris,
it still has like a functional it still looks functional, but it feels completely different. And it just has, I mean, Solaris, even before Star Wars, that's kind of the one to do the broken down lived in sci-fi.
Yes.
And also, you know, just those ties to nostalgia. And I don't know like what kind of a influence it might have had on the creation of Star Wars, because like, you know, Solaris isn't exactly the heart pounding entertainment.
It's
a fantastic film, but just like aesthetically, this idea of, you know, because it was sort of a response to the aesthetics of Space Odyssey, where, you know, like you said, everything's sort of new and shiny and futuristic and
Forbidden Planet.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and of course, Soviet Union, you see how this stuff gets beat up and reused and tinkered with. And, you know, I love, like, the space station in Solaris. It's like people have paintings up there. Like, what's a painting doing in outer space, you know?
Yeah.
It sort of immediately kind of makes you think differently about how we occupy outer space.
That's kind of what a lot of these science fiction stories, movies, if you will, kind of lack that understanding. That more than it being lived in, just kind of, you know, I feel like, honestly, in terms of just thinking about the science fiction I watched in 2019, Ad Astra was just ridiculous. I think High Life probably Claire Denis High Life came closer to that.
My favorite of the year.
Yeah.
And High Life definitely feels like in the school of exactly. Solaris kind of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Ad Astra felt like he really, really wanted to make something profound, but he didn't have a profound script. You know what I mean? And so yeah. It ends up being a movie about like space baboons and like...
That was ridiculous. I was like, wait, are the monkeys really going to attack now? Okay.
Oh my God. My suspicion was that he had this screenplay planned out, and like Gray, you see his other movies, they're very like slow and kind of like...
Yeah. I feel like subdued. He has half of it right with everything he does. And
Me too. But yeah. Like, I feel like with Ad Astra especially, there was probably like some producer in the corner being like, if you want that full budget, you better put in an exciting scene. Now write a moon buggy space chase, like throw in the space baboon, like throw in an action scene, like every couple, because it was almost rhythmic, you know, you could almost feel like, oh, another one's coming up, another dumb sci-fi action moment's going to be shoehorned in.
They're like, oh, hey, like, you know, 30 minutes in, I'm getting tired, I'm going to fall asleep, so I need something to happen. Like, it absolutely felt that way. I just saw Aniara, if I'm saying that right, which is like a Swedish-Danish sci-fi film, which kind of honestly feels like a sadder, darker version of WALL-E.
That sounds awesome.
In a weird way it kind of is. I feel like the blockbusters are kind of very much just the same thing over and over again, unfortunately.
I feel like it has something to do with the nerd culture becoming mainstream, and like science fiction is in some ways less niche, so it's like become more that you have to hit the four quadrants, lowest common denominator kind of science fiction. Right. Like, it's probably more egregious with Star Trek than Star Wars.
Yeah,
where you know, that's
I've heard the stories about the Picard series.
Well, like, I mean, you can again, like, Star Wars, trace it all back to J.J. Abrams. I feel like
it's sad but true, isn't it? It's like
I don't even hate the 2009 Star Trek movie, because it's like, oh, this is fun and entertaining and the cast is good and all that.
Yeah.
But it's not a Star Trek movie. It's like a Star Wars movie in disguise.
And, yeah, it is. Exactly.
And now it's just like J.J. Abrams went and made like a Star Wars movie wearing Star Wars' skin. Like,
it's the Star Wars movie with the orange stripe on it.
You're right. Paint a stripe on it. It's something new.
I think you're onto it. I think that it's just more mainstream. So then we've got to make it so that, you know, we can sell tickets, if you will. So that's unfortunately the decision there, as opposed to like when Star Wars came out. I mean, like a big successful like science fiction movie made like less than a quarter of what Star Wars ended up doing. And that was considered successful at the time for science fiction. It just had such a niche audience. So I guess, you know, because of Star Wars, you know, the positives, obviously, like what it did for the industry and how it's even changed everything. Even now, it's still been influenced by Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the negatives that goes along with it, if you will, is that the creative side and the creative freedom is less and less.
I sort of wonder what would have happened if, instead of returning to Star Wars for the prequels, Lucas had said, well, I'm done with Star Wars, I'm going to just make something new.
Yeah.
I think, like, he was sort of, in some ways, trapped by his own success. I know, like, Francis Ford Coppola's talked a little bit about that. Like, you know, Lucas, it's sort of too bad he never really... He has a lot of, like, side projects, and he's produced a lot of great films that are kind of under the radar. Like, you know, you see his name come up, like, oh, like, that's right, he helped get Mishima: Life in Four Chapters made, or helped Kurosawa's come back, and, like, oh, you know, he did do a lot of other projects, but it feels like, you know, the Star Wars, it's just dominated his career.
And like where like George Lucas wanted to finish the story of Anakin Skywalker, and I feel like, you know, we're so trapped in this one tiny little time period with Star Wars, whereas like if you know, there's so much more that could be explored, and so many different other characters, and I think I read somewhere that Disney's going to decide to focus on the Old Republic. I mean, it at some point, like, you know, just move on from
all the new stuff to the ground,
like, like like, just move away from... I mean, if you were going to keep doing Star Wars, which I honestly... I mean, I wish it would be the last one. It's funny, like, I dug up... it was, like, I think it was, like, a Time magazine from, like, 2005, and it was, like, the last Star Wars. And I just, like... I know you remember that, Martin. It was like, oh, no, yeah, Revenge of the Sith is the last one forever. What are we going to do? Like, there's no more Star Wars.
In Boyhood, with when the kid's talking to his... dad, and he's like, do you think there's ever going to be like another Star Wars movie?
Oh boy. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that scene, but it was just such a... It felt like Star Wars was done finally, and even George Lucas, he did go on to other projects, and I know, he didn't direct it, but he made Red Tails.
He
made that CGI creature musical thing that I can't remember the name of, Strange something.
Yeah, I was going to say the Young Indiana Jones Adventures.
I like Young Indiana Jones.
Nope, that's before that.
Did you read the interview with George Lucas talking about what his idea for a sequel trilogy would have been? I think in the James Cameron book, he explains some of his ideas.
I didn't read the entire interview. I just read snippets of it.
And they're bonkers.
That's my point. I will take bonkers George over Disney safe any day. Telling you.
And he's talking about the midichlorians controlled by the Wills who are it's nonsense talk. And that's kind of what I want.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I want. Yeah. I mean,
there's no part of me that doubts it would have been awful.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I kind of want to see it.
But it would have been tremendous. You know,
it would have been tremendous.
Set design, costumes, music, everything, just how outlandish it would have been. That doesn't come close to me in terms of nostalgia and just how much I loved Star Wars for a long time, but the closest I can get to it in terms of a sci-fi fantasy right now, and it's much more adult, is Saga, honestly. I don't know if you've read
the
Saga.
Comic book series?
Yeah,
it's great. There's a couple of, it's hard to think of stuff off the top of my head, but there are good long form kind of fantasy or science fiction stories, in comics or in games or, other media.
Right.
I mean, serialized storytelling is hard because I feel like a lot of it is self-sustaining until it isn't, and then it has a bad ending.
They don't know when to end things, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Star Wars, it was a bit different because it had an ending and it kind of went back to the beginning. You sent me the article about the ring cycle theory.
That ring theory.
Star Wars. And, it's a really, I don't necessarily agree with everything it
it's interesting.
Says, but, it's an interesting way of looking at those films and how they're structured. And it's not a typical serialized story because you start in the middle and end in the middle.
Yeah. The whole, I think, tired thing at this point, and a lot of people use it to mock George Lucas at this point, but the it rhymes and it's a poem thing. I mean, it kind of...
I mean, that's beautiful.
I do, too.
Star Wars... pulling on the, sort of Joseph Campbell monomyth.
Yes.
And, having echoes of these very ancient stories, it is an epic poem when you watch it,
It is. I guess the whole universe or all these people in different forms, different races, whatever, whatnot, just kind of coming together to defeat evil.
The heroes were always the underdogs,
Correct.
Scrappy, barely getting by the skin of their teeth and getting back to Ewoks or...
Yeah.
Oh, they're tiny teddy bears, but...
Taking on the Empire.
Gonna stand up to the Empire or, Yoda, right. Of course, is... probably the best example where it's they sort of set up this idea that Yoda is going to be this great warrior, and what you see challenges that, and it's trying to present something more thoughtful, that a Jedi master doesn't have to be giant guy with a sword. It can be a little creature who's just sort of spiritually attuned and wise and all of that.
Right. And so as silly as the Gungans are, I mean, that's that parallel in the first one. And so there's kind of always that, there's always that setting of a place that's new and a different people in this massive universe that is depicted as being a part of that struggle and trying to break free from the evil empire. And I just feel that that's also kind of lacking from the newer ones, this idea that there's this big threatening menace that's destroying everybody's way of life.
It doesn't make any sense
based on
how Return of the Jedi ends.
No,
it just feels there was very little thought put into, Empire's back. We can't call them the Emperor because the Empire is destroyed. Call them something else. And, they still have Star Destroyer. It doesn't make any sense.
The fans will think it's cool that
world,
it's the Star Killer. Yeah, that just seemed honestly, a bunch of posers that are, wish they were, the Emperor. And obviously, they feel like they wish they were Darth Vader and all these things. And they don't really measure up, if you will. So, and then... kind of, I guess it was supposed to be threatening and scary that now they can kill multiple planets at the same time or something. And it was just okay.
It's so dumb.
I just don't what? and how close those planets were together, and how people would see, and then how they would
and
see each
other.
And
how a laser moves, and,
yeah.
and everything.
Well, and like, I get Star Wars doesn't get science. I know because the TIE fighters make noise in space and all that stuff, sure. But, like, yeah. I mean, still, that was even a little ridiculous for Star
what,
Wars.
What it makes me think of is, you know, in Spaceballs, when it parodies the shot of the Star Destroyer, but it gets, like, comically long?
Yes.
It's like that. It's like, oh, wow, like a giant Death Star. It's... that's awesome. That's terrifying. That's so cool. Like a mega ultra supersized planet sized Star Destroyer or a Death Star that blows up a bunch of planets at once. Like
yeah.
it just pushes it into that absurd kind of parody territory. We can't
yeah.
take it seriously anymore. You know, it just
it's very gone
it
to plaid.
Far.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
or we've been jammed. Right? Yeah. It's, it is like quite literally Spaceballs. Yeah.
It is Spaceballs.
But yeah, that ring theory is cool though, because this guy that did this, that came up with this theory, and feels like he found all these connections. The articles, and he's on Twitter too. It's Mike Klimo. I think I said his name right. He does a lot of like interesting parallels. Like he'll compare the movies, the six movies to each other. I think the ring theory, the rhyme scheme, if you will, is it's The Phantom Menace with Return of the Jedi, Attack of the Clones with Empire, and Revenge of the Sith with A New Hope. And just the way that the stories flow and even different imagery and different scenes, he found a way that they're all parallels of each other. So, you know, whether or not it was on purpose, who knows? It's just something kind of cool to look at and to just kind of to see things that are similar.
I mean, at least some of it's deliberate because,
yeah.
you know, you see behind the scenes of Lucas talking about, oh yeah, he's going to blow up the droid ship that's going to be like blowing up the Death Star. Like, he's
right.
conscious of this.
Right.
And I mean, to me, it's interesting too. Like, the more I read about or, you know, get into myths from other cultures and history, like just seeing those echoes
yeah.
in Star Wars, like just, you know, Lucas the historian, Lucas the anthropologist, how much he worked into.
Yes.
It, you know, it's like so much that like I think that you might not, it's easy to overlook or not appreciate when you're younger. But I mean, the way I sort of think of it for myself is like a postmodern myth where you take elements from all these different cultures and time periods and kind of mash them together to create like a sort of single
yes.
story that we can find something of value in. I think that's part of Star Wars' mass appeal.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Really, like, it's always been, like, you know, unlike a lot of the blockbusters that came after, it's like a cult film that coincidentally, I think, appeals to everyone in a way.
Yeah, and at this point, how many generations, too? I mean, if you think about,
yeah
and it's staying power, if you will, and just internationally, how it was accepted at the time. So, yeah, there's definitely something that, it's kind of incredible if you think about it, that kind of resonates with a lot of people. I guess it's just that traditional story, like you mentioned, with good and evil, but also just somehow how they came up with that mystical, spiritual element of it, which somehow just kind of found commonality with the East and the West, the different religions, which is very impressive. Considering the differences.
I haven't seen the new one, but
nope,
I bet
me either.
I bet you it's going to end with you know,
the Emperor
killing the Emperor, you know, and it's going to be good times. So it's going to be like
sure.
a very dumbed down interpretation of this. I don't know, like some of the like changes, just you know, within the Disney films
yeah.
that you kind of pick up on, that the kind of like you said focus group stuff.
It very much
it
is
sort of bothers
yeah.
me. Like I don't know, I had like some issues with what they did with the Finn character, especially in the Last Jedi.
Oh yeah. No growth
you
at
know,
all. Is that what you're
like,
getting at as a character?
No growth
yeah.
and kind of like relegate him to like, he, you know, he's almost the main character in the first one. And then they like bump him down to like a secondary character,
yeah.
put him off on the like B plot. And
yeah.
even like, I don't know, I might cut this out because this might be controversial, but like,
go ahead.
I'm really suspicious that they're going to set up like a romance between him and the Rey character. Like, it seems like they were going in that direction in the first one.
Yes.
And then
absolutely the way he felt about her.
Like, I know that interracial relationships don't always test well with like certain audiences, unfortunately. So I think that's part of the reason why they squashed that.
Oh god, I hope not, because that's
like,
that's
Finn
awful.
Rey. That's my suspicion.
But
when
you
watch
though?
The films back to back, I think that's what happened, you know. And like,
people still have issues with, you know, I mean, I have a hard time with this because I feel like a lot of people that say this have like little to no knowledge of film history when they're like, oh, finally women in the leads and women directing movies. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, is there still just a blockbuster new release section? Like, what's happening? Like, I don't understand. But like,
that's the thing. It's like all of history has been erased except like
the last 20 years, like
last 20 years and blockbusters. And like, now it's going to be all erased except Disney. Yeah. And movies are just going to be called Disney's.
Yeah. That's kind of where I feel about it. Cause it's just like, wait a minute. Cause it's like, they're like, oh, cause finally a strong character, Rey. And it's like, excuse me. Like what? There's like Leia in 1977. And there's like, you know, it was just a huge deal then. And then, Padme, even though she was kind of did nothing but be pregnant in Revenge of the Sith, was kind of important. I mean, like,
she was
okay.
Important, and like, she's positioned as being like a strong leader, and
yeah, so what?
People talk about Last Jedi like, oh, it's so cool to see the woman in a position of leadership and standing up to like a guy questions her. I'm like, that
wait a
it
minute.
Does that terribly, like, yeah, you know, there's a tiny bit in Empire Strikes Back where Leia's explaining the plan for how they're going to escape the Empire.
Yes.
You know, as they're coming down on the Hoth, on the planet Hoth.
Yeah.
All troop carriers will assemble at the north entrance. The heavy transport ships will leave as soon as they're loaded. Only 2 fighter escorts per ship. The energy shield can only be opened for a short time, so you'll have to stay very close to your transports.
2 fighters against a Star Destroyer?
The ion cannon will fire several shots to make sure that any enemy ships will be out of your flight path. When you've gotten past the energy shield, proceed directly to the rendezvous point. Understood?
Yeah.
Good luck.
She explains the plan in a clear, logical way. You know, somebody says like, oh, a couple fighters against a Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
She gives them an answer that like, oh, the cannon's going to help. And, you know,
yeah,
she assures them, and then she motivates them. And like, that's such a great example of leadership in a film. And it's like, to see another movie completely struggle with that and then pat itself on the back is terrible.
Yeah. And like, and they did this similar thing with Padme's character in The Phantom Menace, like at the end when she's like, you know, leading them into the palace and the whole thing. And so it's just like, I remember that with Leia. I remember that with her, and then I'm like, wait a minute, like, these movies aren't all obscure, guys.
I love like, even though, you know, it's sort of like the damsel in distress kind of trope with them coming to save Leia, like, you know, as soon as they're there, she's the one in charge, like, there's never any doubt. And, you know, she's not just like the
into the garbage chute fly boy.
Like, I mean it's so great, you know, and like, it immediately kind of makes you gravitate to her as a leader. Like, I think out of all the characters, like, she's the leader, right? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it's almost like, as much as I love Fate Ray and I love the original King Kong, it's like, it's almost like people still think that movies before 1990 had women treated that way.
Right.
It's like,
I just think of, like, olive oil in the Popeye cartoons, like, save me, with the arms waving in the air. You know, Leia was tough and independent, and even if she had to be saved, doesn't mean she was going to let herself get bossed around.
Right.
Like, you know, that's cool. Like,
exactly.
And, you know, they all save each other at some point. Like, Luke has to be saved. You know, it's not like she was alone in that. So,
right.
So I don't know. I really like Princess Leia as a character. Like,
she's a wonderful character. Yeah.
Wonderful character. Do you have a favorite character? Or
in Star Wars in general, it's R2-D2. It's always been R2-D2. Yeah. And I think, honestly, because it probably was several things at the time. Like, I've always had pet birds growing up, parrots, and just his voices and his beeps and the way he responds to things remind me a lot of the pet birds I've had, and the one I have now. I don't know if you've ever had a pet, like a pet bird or a parrot, or know anybody that has. They're very much like having like a small child, the way that they're just very dependent, mm-hmm. very smart, make lots of noises to mean different things. And so it kind of always reminded me of that. And then I know Ben Burtt, when he said he came up with the sound, which is like another thing we didn't discuss, just the sounds in Star Wars. Like, Ben Burtt created a lot of them from scratch. And now, I mean, I hear, you know, even blockbusters now that are clearly using a lot of those original ILM sounds that he created, just like walking around like a parking lot or an airport or playing with like scuba gear, and he came up with all these sounds. But anyway, so it's always been R2-D2 for that reason, and just for just kind of his importance as this, even though he's kind of one of the plucky characters from basically the Hidden Fortress with C-3PO.
Yeah.
Kind of always that, you know, if he's not there, then they're, you know, they're not going to make it out. The three heroes, you know, whichever movie it is. That importance he has. And then, of course, he's kind of thrown off in the corner and put to sleep in the new ones. And because BB-8 is cool now. And BB-8 just...
He's around. He's cuter. Go away.
So ridiculous. It's and like, it's just like, you know what? I am a lot like
R2-D2 people get the new puppy and like the old dog has to like...
That's exactly what it is. And it's like, and it's funny. I was like, when I saw the new one, then they're like, oh, R2-D2 is asleep. And I was like, what? Like, did you guys ever watch the other like Star Wars movies? Like one of the cool things about those movies was that, oh, hey, like so-and-so is going to die. And he opened the door, you know, on Cloud City, or he, you know, saves Luke in the Death Star. Or he, you know, saved Padme on this planet and saved Anakin here, or whatever. He's always doing things for the heroes in these ridiculous situations. But, you know, I guess BB-8 is going to sell us some toys, so we're going to put him under a blanket, and I'll be under the blanket with R2-D2 in the corner. Tell me when the movie's over.
Although, I'm not going to lie, like, when that first trailer came out for the new Star Wars, I was like, whoa, like, a ruling R2-D2. I was totally into
it. It was very cool, and they had him on stage.
Honestly, I thought in the trailer, like, you know, they always have characters that look really cool to sell toys that aren't really significant in the final film.
Yes.
I was so sure the BB-8 was going to be that.
Yeah.
You know, I thought like, oh, they're going to hype him up and then he's going to be like in the movie for 2 seconds. I didn't know he was going to be like a main character.
Yeah, he's R2-D2's. He took his job.
But, you know, there's still a lot of like Constable Juvio action figures collecting dust, so.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, or like the people that got the Jar Jar Binks tattoos before the Phantom Menace came out.
Yes.
I love those so much.
Oh my God. That's great.
There's a friend of mine who has a podcast, So Wizard Podcast, and they talk about like a lot of nerdy stuff. It's a pretty great like comic, just like nerd podcast. Cool. A friend of his around that time got really hyped about, for whatever reason, Sebulba. Or was it Sebulba? No, it was Watto. I'm sorry. It was Watto. And tried to purchase a life-size Watto statue on eBay.
I'm kind of into that.
I know I'm missing a lot of details of the story, but apparently something happened where, like, it was, he completely got cheated. Never actually got the statue.
So he did get the full Watto experience.
Yeah, yeah, but I love how it was, like, the life-size Watto statue. It was like, okay. So, it's not as bad as a tattoo.
My trick's gonna work on me. All the money.
Oh, boy. We could talk about the racism in Star Wars, the Trade Federation. I mean,
we might as well address it since we're here. But like, I think part of it is like Lucas is referencing all these like 1930s, 1940s, World War II era.
Absolutely is, yeah.
Media, and he kind of like does Absolutely. It without, without a second thought, putting those things in. I think he thinks like, oh, okay, if I make an obvious stand-in for like Imperial Japan and alien, then that's not technically racist because it's an alien,
right?
Except like it just comes across like a caricature.
I mean, my brother and I used to joke about this a lot, like those end space battles and in all of his George's movies 1 to 6, usually as the movies go on, like in terms of release order, he's got more diversity with the pilots.
I noticed that too.
Yeah, like
so, part of it's just like, you know, changing expectations in general, and like,
yeah,
I know George Lucas, sometimes it just seems like he's trying really hard for people, like,
yeah.
I just think of like when he was doing the press for Red Tails, and he's like, nobody's ever done this. He just like, not so much racist, but out of touch, I think, is maybe the best way to describe how I feel about his outlook.
And more of a man of his time, if you want to say it that way. Sure. I don't know if that is the right way to say it, but I think you're right too. I think a lot of it is, you know, he's making his Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, and these things were normal and okay then. So that's kind of how he just sees it from that childish, nostalgic lens. I mean, I don't think he means anything bad by it, even though it's not appropriate. I think it's just more that whole his generation enjoying that, if you will.
Yeah.
Although, like I said, I do find it humorous every once in a while when you're like, oh, we have brought the checklist. We have to make sure that they're in there, and there they are. Like, so.
But sometimes, like, the effort to make a more diverse Star Wars, you know, sometimes I think it has, like, the counter effect, like, in the sequel trilogy where, you know, you take the Evil Empire, which was, like, a stand-in for Nazis, and it's like, oh, great, like, now we have an inclusive, diverse space Nazi group.
Yeah,
and
it's like, I think you guys didn't get the memo.
No, and, like, a part of it, I think it's like, oh, you know, that way we can, like, sell Star Wars helmets and stuff to like, a broader group of people, but... you know, there's something very calculated about that, but it kind of dilutes that message of, oh, these are space Nazis, you know?
Yeah. Even the way that, like, Thrawn's character was written a bit, like, pre-Disney. If I remember correctly, he was, like, the only alien Grand Admiral. Like, yeah. That being one of the reasons. I mean, I always understood that Palpatine and the Empire were always racist, like the Nazis, if you will.
Yeah.
So you had to be really...
like Chewbacca to the prisoner department, and they're like, oh, like, where are you taking this thing? Like,
yeah.
You know, it just oozes that sort of racism. You know, even though it's to an alien, like, it's the subtext, and it's part of how you're looking at this evil empire.
Yeah, so that whole, like, way that Disney has handled it feels very, I don't think timely is the word, but, like, very social justice-y, but, like, to a way that seems very forced and, like, very, we just, like you said, we want to just sell helmets. Like, you know, we don't really mean it, but we just, you know, feel like we need to do it in order for you guys to see our movie and buy our products. Like, it's very... So then it's kind of just totally defeating the purpose of, well, if they're evil and they're supposed to be depicting, you know, this type of people in this point in time, then maybe you want to stick with that. Like, it's kind of defeating the purpose and kind of showing them to be better than they really are, if you will. So, I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, not to keep picking on the sequel films, but it's like so much of the original trilogy, it's obviously referencing World War II. And...
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's a big part of it. Like, the sequel films, they're not really addressing any real war. They're like,
no.
They're not referencing World War II. They're referencing Star Wars. You know, it's become this sort of insular.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that's where we kind of are with blockbusters, is it's kind of like, I don't know if it's like you said, that how nerd culture is mainstream now, and they're just, you know, I guess like Spielberg and Lucas and Coppola and all of them were referencing what they liked from the 50s and the 60s, and then now I guess we're referencing what we liked from the 80s still, and so it's kind of like, you know, I guess it's there's a lot lacking there. There's no depth, if you will. It's kind of like there's no understanding of where everything came from, what it's referencing. So we're, like you said, we're referencing ourselves. So these all feel like fan films more than they feel like actual new entries to these different series that we're creating. So I guess it's also on these people making these films that they don't have any knowledge pre what they like in order to kind of grow from it and to be creative. It's very anti-understanding history, and it's like, well, it's really important that you do understand history. I mean, it's the old saying, like, so you don't repeat, you know, the terrible things that has happened in the past. That's the whole point, so that you can grow from it.
Like, one thing that sort of bothered me about Last Jedi, it has this theme of failure is important, but not about learning from failure.
No.
Like,
because we're going to basically ignore it.
And it's all about basically reaffirming everything that you've already seen before, in which case, like, the whole burning the history kind of point is pointless. Like, if that's
right.
If you're doing it to just re-uphold the status quo, except now it's devoid of meaning and it's sort of like drained of its context and its history, then, you know, it just becomes this sort of empty thing.
It becomes very empty, because then what are we doing? You know, the whole point is to learn from your mistakes, you know, and we're kind of deciding that we don't make mistakes. I mean, that's not realistic in any way. So it's like that, and then then there's no character growth, which is an issue that, like you said, with Finn, for example, that he's just kind of relegated to these. What did he do in that exactly? Like,
I don't. He went to he saved horses, space horses.
It was very like prequels, but like bad prequel. Like
that was right out of the prequels.
Yeah, and then it was like, oh, I guess he thinks he's being creative because this is like a tracking shot from Wings that people tweet all the time. Like.
I feel bad, though, for the actors who take a lot of the flack for the decisions of the creative people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I remember, it was like a little while ago, Ahmed Best, who played Jar Jar Binks, talked about, like, he even thought about suicide after, just because, like, so many people
People are just very cruel to people. Yeah.
Or, you know, sort of more recently, like, you know, I saw a lot of negativity directed at Kelly Marie Tran.
Yeah, it was out of control. Yeah.
It's one thing to not like a character, but to take it out on the performer feels really mean and juvenile. And, like, to anyone who makes those kinds of criticisms of the actors, I feel like if somebody came along and said, hey, do you want to be in Star Wars? And you said, yeah, you would play Jar Jar Binks too.
Exactly. And then honestly, like a lot of these, I mean, that goes back to the very first one. Like they thought they were making, you know, some ridiculous movie that was going to fail and they had no idea what was going on. And I know Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford said that quite a bit, that like the whole thing felt weird. It felt stupid. Like they just, you know, were trying to, you know, keep George Lucas awake and he just seemed totally like disinterested and he was miserable. And like everybody thought it was crap that they were making in the first hour. Movie, they had no idea. I mean and then they see the movie in theaters after, you know, everything, the score's added, it's edited properly, and the whole, and it's like the biggest movie of all time, you know. So a lot of these actors don't know. I mean, they're just on the set going through the motions, and then these people online, you know, are just kind of that are, you know, we're not in a Star Wars movie, are yelling from our couches and on our computers. I mean, like,
yeah,
it's absolutely ridiculous.
That's part of, like, the fan outrage. It's always sort of directed
silly.
At the wrong place. And
very much so.
Silly and, you know, very, usually very, like, mean-spirited. That's one thing that's kind of made me drop out of Star Wars conversations. And, like, even casually, like, you know, if I'm on Twitter, I'll post something like...
Yeah.
Even if it's just, like, a GIF without any kind of commentary or context, I'll still get some kind of dicky comment that, like, you know, I don't... really like blocking people.
No,
you know, it's usually just like if they're rude to me or rude to somebody, I, you know, and I can see it. But, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek and all those kinds of things, they really bring it out of people.
I think it's just all the different generations involved in it now. You know, it's got to be what it is, because it's my parents, you know, it's me, it's kids now, and then, you know, you're tied and you have emotional attachments to the ones you've seen. And, you know, I mean, you have to be able to step away from it and realize, you know, I guess Galaxy Quest, it's not all real.
Right.
and people are going to make bad decisions on things you love. And I have accepted that George Lucas has basically become Darth Vader and he's no longer a small company.
Although I'll say the Star Wars prequels to me hurt way less than like the Matrix sequels or the Hobbit prequels to Lord of the Rings. Like I think the like Hobbit out of prequels. All of these, like, well, that's what they are. It's like, it's not
they're
a
so
movie version of The Hobbit. It's like we're gonna make a prequel trilogy to Lord of the Rings, you know.
Oh my god.
I, you know what, I used to love the Lord of the Rings films, and I feel like I haven't been able to go back and watch them since the Hobbit movies came out. It's like it took it out of me. I can't do it.
I mean, when you get back to them, they are still wonderful. But yeah, the Hobbit movies were just, oh my god.
At that point, I felt almost trained for a creator who made something really special coming back to a franchise decades later.
Yeah.
That I thought for sure that Mad Max Fury Road was going to be a disaster. And it wasn't. It was really good.
It's another lightning in a bottle scenario. Like, really. Like, I know that's kind of overused, but, like, that movie is perfect. And it's
kind of like the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, that was probably, like, in recent memory, one of the better experiences I've had with a movie in theaters. But yeah, but I mean, God, those Hobbit movies, now I can't stop thinking about them.
Sorry, I had to bring them up.
The Goblin King, like, and that was just like,
oh my God.
I almost like left.
Yeah, I would contend that the prequel Star Wars movies are better than the Hobbit trilogy.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. Absolutely.
there's moments in the prequels that I really do think are like amazing and special. And like, I love, Revenge of the Sith, when you see those Star Destroyers kind of lining up, firing at each other broadside, like battleships, and you see, like, wow, like, that's how they're always meant to be used, you know, you always saw them chasing these little ships, and you sort of get this, like, wow factor, you know, when Anakin has to land that spaceship that looks like the Chrysler building, and it's just, like, burning up in the atmosphere.
It's very cool. Yeah.
Like, there's still great stuff in there, you know, it's
absolutely
sort of
is.
Shame
yeah.
that it's kind of weighed down, but it does feel like, you know, it wouldn't have taken too many changes to make it like George Lucas's Fury Road kind of a thing, you know, like they could have been as good as the originals. Like I think Revenge of the Sith, it's almost as good as Return of the Jedi, but I think you're looking at like the high point of a, you know, lower end thing, and then like Return of the Jedi is kind of the, in some ways, the low point of the higher end thing. Like,
yeah, Return of the Jedi reeks of the prequels. Yeah,
it's again, like, maybe my
beginning.
Favorite, but it's like you can see all the problems in the prequels starting there. Like, if you know where to look, it's like it's all incubating, you know, like every
it is.
Narrative, like you sort of go, wait, like what was the plan again for rescuing Han Solo? And it like makes no sense. And you start to realize a lot of things that you can criticize in the prequels are already present there. And I think partly it was through George Lucas kind of chasing away his closest collaborators and, micromanaging the film. But
yes. And like a lot of people have said, like, I think people were also afraid to say no to him.
I think so. Like, you know, because he's the guy who made Star Wars. Like if he's
still the greatest blockbuster of all time. I don't even think that's going to change. Yeah. I mean, that's another thing with the prequels that I love is the ingenuity and the creativity with the different locations and all the world building and how well that was thought out. I mean, even though languages are not created, you know, it's still a lot of it is still superficial. I mean, just one of the planets I really liked in Revenge of the Sith was Utapau, like the sinkhole planet.
Oh, that's really cool.
It's very cool. Yeah. Just the idea that it's kind of very like 50s science fiction journey to the center of the earth, the way that Obi-Wan has like this that huge iguana that he's kind of like riding like going after Grievous.
It's a little goofy, but yeah.
It's like if you just think of it from that mindset of like those great like them and like B science fiction movies, it just totally works on that level for me. And I feel like Star Wars has always kind of succeeded at being really silly, so it's kind of, you know, you embrace that as a lot more enjoyable.
Like some of the visual patterning I've always really liked, like in the originals there's so many great visual motifs, like the two signs and then the sort of mirrors, like the circles in R2-D2 and like these kind of reoccurring patterns that are like really really interesting. There's like a visual rhythm to it, and I think like that's one thing that does kind of get extended into the prequels that I like all the design work is really incredible. Like I love the battle droids, you know, and how it's this like instant army where they, you know, come out on racks and they all stand up at once, you know, and just the look of them, and they look kind of like cheap and disposable. Like you can kind of tell that they're not meant to be a huge threat, but it's such a fantastic design those sorts of images. I still like them.
I like how initially, like I think they were supposed to have those for that Naboo in battle sequence in the fields with the battle droids. They were supposed to, I can't remember what they were called, but those huge tanks that were like transporting those battle droids were supposed to open with the lid on the top. And then thankfully they realized it looked like a toilet if they did that.
No, the way it ends up in the final film, it's probably best.
I just thought that was always funny when I learned that.
I did, like, in the original concept art, the Trade Federation aliens, they look more like their heads were the shape of the battle droids, which I kind of wish they went with, because, you know, it sort of would make sense to make the robots look like the whoever's designing them, and that,
right.
I don't know. I just like that design better, and I don't know why they didn't go with that. Maybe it was harder to have, like, an actor in a suit, or if they would have had to use CGI or something like that. Jar Jar kind of has that shape of head where it, you know, comes to a beak point, but...
except for Boss Nass, who somehow doesn't.
Another element that works pretty well in the prequels is Ian McDermott's rise to power. Not everything's perfect, like we already sort of mentioned, but I love how much of a troll he is. Democracy, or, you know, he's like
oh,
careful, Obi-Wan, he's a Sith Lord. Like he's just like, it's so obvious.
Like... Yeah, or like the end of even like the Phantom Menace, where he's like, "Oh, and you, young Skywalker, will watch your career with great interest." And I was like, "Oh boy, like, oh no, yeah."
Do you want to hear my 20-year-old dumb fan theory?
Oh no. Okay, go ahead.
this is from like after Episode 1 came out, but before Attack of the Clones came out.
Okay.
What I thought was going to happen, like what I thought it was going to build up to, because I'm like, it's weird that they would have Darth Sidious and Palpatine going around, and like, you know, it's the same guy, and it's just like sort of an obvious, like there's no plot reveal. Mm-hmm. So what I thought was going to happen is I thought the Palpatine that we see, who's like a good guy who's going to like rise through the ranks politically, I thought he was going to turn out to be a clone of the Emperor, who just was like an identical clone, and at a certain point that's how he could avoid detection from the Jedi. He would just kill him and take his place, and like nobody would notice, and that's why it would be the Clone Wars, because it would like trigger that, you know, some people would find out.
This is very red letter media right now, Martin.
Sorry.
It's okay.
People forget the reception to the prequels was really positive initially, and then like all the negativity starts coming out like a little while after, but like I remember people were really, really high on Phantom Menace, and like, I feel like every Star Wars film that's been released in my lifetime, there's a certain percentage of the media that's like, oh yeah, it's the best Star Wars film since Empire. I'm sure it's been happening since Empire came out. You know, it's always, people always say it's the best Star Wars film since Empire.
It's so exhausting. It's like, that's why I like, you know, I feel like every single newer one, the sequels, I was like, I've got to keep reading, you know, these little like quick snippets of these reviews until I see somebody say it's, you know, it's the best Star Wars since Empire. And sure enough, I only have to like read like the first review.
That's always like the first opinion that's like trotted out. And it's,
yeah,
it's because film media outlets have a vested interest in basically publicizing these movies. And
exactly.
I don't know, except I think like the only one I've seen get like almost universally immediate backlash was the one that just came out.
Yeah.
There was like some initial positivity, but it was like pretty quick the negative stuff, which makes me feel like it's probably not just bad, but really bad.
Yeah.
I would guess.
I know I have to see it at some point, but honestly,
I'm not going to pay to see that.
I'm not paying to see that. I always try to go into things without any bias, but it's really hard for me with Star Wars because of just how much I loved it for a long time. And then the fact that it went from, you know, it was Anakin Skywalker, became Darth Vader, literally. Like, so it's just kind of like, you know, it's no longer that small movie that was risky, and it's no longer nobody telling George no, and he's getting overly excited and putting lots of things in it, and now it's just, oh hey, we did a focus group and everybody in this focus group loves the original trilogy, and so we're just gonna do that as much as possible over and over again. And so it's just, you know, I guess, you know, so that's unfair somewhat that I'm going in with.
No,
that,
I think that's totally fair. That like,
it's also,
if they're going to be films that exploit that nostalgia and exploit your attachment, then I think it's fair to say it doesn't live up to that.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, I think that's completely fair because that's what these films are kind of counting on.
It is. And it's kind of, it's also in somewhat like, you know, oh, well, I'm a real fan. That whole argument. It's like, well, you know, everybody that likes Star Wars is a fan, regardless of what it is.
Right.
But like, you know,
all the gatekeeping is really nasty.
It's ridiculous. Some of those, but like, you know, I feel I can say I was a fan of it for a long time, enough to be like, you know what, it's maybe, you know, I don't know if it's I've outgrown it. I think more Star Wars has decided it likes different people, not me.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it's decided it doesn't want me as its audience anymore. And I feel like when, even though the prequels were really popular, maybe it was different for you, Martin, but it wasn't necessarily the coolest thing to talk about. Like,
no, I mean, it was
in
always
the late
90s.
Nerdy.
It's
especially the late 90s.
These films
90s.
Were huge, but if you were like into Star Wars, like you were nerdy. I was a nerd. I'm not afraid to say it.
Yeah, like I remember like I was writing like Ewok fan fiction in like 1990s, like 1997, awesome. And like getting criticized and made fun of for it. And so like, I mean, I guess that's the positive now with like Star Wars.
You've seen my Jar Jar Binks t-shirt.
It's the cool, and like, you know, I was dressed up as Padme for Halloween, and like, you know,
I've gone out as Star Wars characters for Halloween too. Yeah.
And so like, you know, so now I guess that's the good thing with it is that this stuff is I mean, that's the positive, that it's mainstream now and people can, even more so than it was before, and like little girls can be all into it. But that's kind of the only only real positive I see from it right now, unfortunately.
The tragedy of George Lucas the Wise, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I want to like wave my flag and be like, yeah, go George. But he also did sell it, so.
Yeah, after making the prequels, would you really feel like making a sequel trilogy after the way people kind of responded to, you know, his vision? It's like, I might as well let somebody else do it, you know. So that, I get that, but that must be hard, you know. You create this thing and see what they do with it. And, well, I think that
we killed this episode, Martin.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on. That was really something.
Thank you.
We celebrate a day of peace, a day of harmony, a day of joy we all can share together, joy. A day that takes us through the darkness. A day that leads us into life. A day that makes us want to celebrate the night.